Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Pulling Heartstrings with the Matriarch here on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM. We are live in a studio. We are here. The number in studio is 083-288-401. That is the number in studio. So yesterday we were talking about the seven kinds of rests, and we are now continuing with other things, right? The continuation of our conversation was that we're going to be talking about the different, this week we're going to be talking about the different types of things. So it's the different types of the risk, the different types of love, the different types of. Okay. So apparently, there are a couple kinds of love. It's so twisted out here. Now you think that, no, I'm in love. Okay. What kind of love? What kind of love are you feeling? So we say things like, oh, I love them. I love them. Love them a lot. I love them. Mara, we don't actually know what kind of love we are feeling for others. And we don't know the names. We don't know the origins. The main types of love include ancient Greek concepts like, this one I was struggling today to try and figure out. Am I going to pronounce it the way I think it is? It is pronounced, or am I going to pronounce it in English? So it's agape. Agape love. Agape. What happy. Hey, I was like, is it a happy? You know, because the Greeks, you know, they also had their own accent, their own thing. So I was like, maybe it's a happy, man. Eh, is it a happy or is it agape? Agape. 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 Okay, but it's a happy. Okay. So we have the agape, a kind of love, which is unconditional love. And then we have eros, which is passionate love. And then we have philia, which is friendship. And then we have storge, which is familiar. And then we have ludus, which is playful. We have pragma, which is enduring. And philautia, which is self-love. So you must be thinking like, okay, so those are complicated. Yeah, they are complicated because it's another person's language. And unfortunately, we are in the times where we have to figure things out, and it is what it is. So I was thinking about the way we say I love you, the way we exude love and we present love, and we keep saying that, you know, like, I love this person, and I'm so passionate. But on the other side of love, right? They are nightmare stories to me. They are stories that come from the grapevines that you would have never thought they actually exist. So today we're starting with the dangerous. Today we're starting with the dangerous, and we are going to mellow it down a little bit with describing the different kinds of love and what they represent and what they are. Then we can see where we fall in. So please, by all means, ladies and gentlemen, please do call in. The number in studio is 083-288-401. And let me know, where do you think you fall in? So we spoke about agape love. This is unconditional, selfless love that expects nothing in return. So that's most probably the love from God, because we as people, we do expect, like, we do expect something from the people that we love, whether it's respect, whether it's due diligence, whether it's compassion. We expect something, whether it's resources even. There are some people that would never love you if you didn't have the resources to actually, accommodate them. They won't love you. Like, no, I don't have it. I don't have it. I don't have it. So agape love is unconditional, selfless love. That is more like the Bible. For me, that's what I feel, that is more like the Bible, because I do not believe that human beings have the capability of loving somebody unconditionally, not unless they are your child. Maybe they are your children. But also we love our children according to who they are, right? We love them, but we love them a little bit more when they are exactly what we expected them to be, in terms of the morals and the principles and the ethics that we teach our children, if they live up to those principles, then we love them just a little bit more. And then even if they don't live up to those principles, we have a tendency of loving them anyway. So maybe it is that one. Okay. And then we have Eros, which is passionate, intense, and often sexual. So I feel like many people have Eros kind of love. They have that Eros airport kind of life. It's like flight. Yeah. It's like flight kind of love, passionate. You know, it is intense. It's usually involved with coitus. And that's now where we can say that I don't know if it's lust or religious love, but okay. And then we have philia, which is a deep, loyal friendship based on mutual respect and trust. This one is the one, like philia, my philia, philia, philia is a friend, philia. Yeah. Aha. All right. So ladies and gentlemen, before that, let us listen to some of their dating stories and we will revert back. But before that, let us have a moment.
The views and opinions expressed by our guests and callers are not those of Eagle FM and any
of its staff. My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I am planning an event for next weekend, eh? And I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
Lipurane ngeno wapumbwa eva tere ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nwe kutite opoye ekukulile. Oshafa fana nongeshefa ili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshiwala. Kono ngeshefa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano. Okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi toda njuka. Okukwetira oipindi konu honda doi inawa. Nune udo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshefa omarudi dayo loka. Opone ujendi fenawa nukumona oijamo ili nawa. Ninge kwata fano na Monica ko Eagle FM. Onora etatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali. Ileko berewa nora etatu natu bali o etatu watatu o mafilane Eagle FM the eye.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We as Eagle Media House do not claim any ownership of any of the clips or audios played in this program. We are strictly using it for illustration purposes.
Here's the deal. Life is really all about love. I'm not just saying that because I'm a father of a newborn baby. I'm saying that because as a teacher and as a therapist, I've seen people basically choose between two things, love or something else. And what I've witnessed and experienced is this. When people choose love, they always choose right. I was asked to speak today on the topic of illumination, and it made me think about the way the light inside us all can shine. And my favorite way is through our love, which can illuminate in our relationships. The most important relationship that we'll ever have is the relationship that we have with ourselves. And next comes the relationships that we share with one another. As simply as I can put it, we are here on this very earth to love and to be loved. And love is light. In a second, what I'd like to do with you today is a brief, relaxing, guided imagery exercise where I'm going to have you close your eyes and consider three expressions of light that can return us to love. I'm going to have you close your eyes and consider three items, and then associate each item with a person in your life. So let's get ready. With that said, you put your feet flat on the floor, palms facing up in your lap, and when you're ready, gently allow your upper eyelids to meet your lower eyelashes. Close your eyes, and let's everyone take a deep breath. Relax your shoulders. The first item I'd like you to picture is the sun. Picture the sun in the big blue sky. Feel the warmth of her rays. And consider how the sun continues to show up every day, sharing its light and energy unconditionally, even on a cold February morning. Is there somebody in your life that reminds you of the sun? Somebody that loves you unconditionally? Picture that person now and feel their love. The next item I'd like you to picture is a lighthouse. See the light emanating from the top of the structure at the ocean's edge, where the sea meets the land, and remember its primary purpose, to help guide sailors and boaters home. Is there somebody in your life that helps guide you home to your authentic self, to the truth of who you are, to the person that you're meant to be, to the path that you're meant to be on? Picture that person now and consider the direction that they're encouraging you to head in. The last item I'd like you to picture is a disco ball. See the light bouncing off of it? Think of the energy in the room where you might find this unique object. Maybe you hear your favorite song playing. Is there somebody in your life that reminds you of a disco ball? Somebody that shows up with a fun-loving energy wherever they are, wherever they go? Picture that person now and consider how they're encouraging you to live in love. Gently float open your eyes. Today I'd like to share a story with you about a student of mine. His name was Daniel. I met Daniel the very first year I was a classroom teacher. I had no experience as a theology teacher in an all-boys prep school, and somehow this little guy, this 103-pound wrestler, he became more of a teacher to me than a student, because he showed me and everybody in the school building how to shine their love and their light by being an example of how it's done. You see, the same year that I met this little guy was the same year that I was cut from the NFL. Felt like a little bit of my light had been taken from me when the Baltimore Ravens told me I could no longer be their quarterback. I had trained with them all summer. I felt like a kid in Disney. I was playing and competing with some of my childhood heroes in stadiums that I had only visited as a fan. Playing in the NFL was an incredible experience. But at the end of the summer, a week before our first game on the last day of cuts, I was released. And I had to return home to New Jersey to figure out a new career. I had graduated from Georgetown University with a degree in psychology, so I guess I could teach that. But I was hired at an all-boys prep school to coach football and teach theology. It's kind of like a life course for the incoming freshmen. Gave me the opportunity to teach the guys the importance of being kind, caring, and thoughtful. It really healed my broken heart. I loved teaching as much as I loved playing football. And that's when I met Daniel. He came into my classroom like a little disco ball. He had an energy and a light about him that everybody wanted to be around. Daniel connected with everybody in the school. I used to love watching him walk the hallways. His smile was reflected back to him in every corner. Athletes, band guys, cool guys, smart guys, teachers and coaches all felt the love of this pint-sized 103-pound wrestler. People loved Daniel because he was free. He was free to be himself. And most of us know how difficult that can be. I remember when Daniel found out it was my birthday during his freshman year. He took it upon himself to create a homemade birthday card for me. He even taped a Starburst candy and a pack of Wrigley's gum to the inside. He presented it to me in front of the class. Daniel was redefining cool, and he made it cool to be thoughtful, caring, and kind. And his classmates loved him for it. It was in this way that our brotherly bond began. And it was during his sophomore year that Daniel started a campaign for me to date his older cousin, Leah, so that we could officially be family. He even brought her to a wrestling match one weekend. I was only there with about one other person, and Daniel had about 15 relatives cheering him on that night. It was a beautiful night. And then Daniel came into school the following Monday, and he was mad. And he said, "Mr. Ward, you brought your girlfriend to my wrestling match when I brought my cousin to introduce you?" I said, "Whoa, Daniel, hold on a second. That girl happens to be my younger sister. And second of all, I didn't know you were trying to play matchmaker that night." Felt like a real compliment to my teachings. My message of love and be loved was really making an impact. For years, I had been practicing shouting commands for the NFL football field, but I had been practicing another message all along. I was never the type of football player that was overly aggressive or tough. I never yelled at my teammates, and I never yell at my students in the classroom. Some people say, this may make people walk all over you. But I believe otherwise. An older teacher once told me, when I first began teaching, that I shouldn't smile in the classroom until after a few months have gone by. I guess the theory is that the students would think I was tough, but I love to smile. And I have a different theory. I believe that the toughest guy in the room is not the football guy. It's the loving guy. It's the most manly thing that could ever be accomplished. It's not that difficult to do, but it requires great thought and courage. I loved football because I thought it was one of the finest team sports. When we were on the field, playing together, relating as teammates, defending each other, protecting each other, doing a little dance in the end zone to celebrate the points we score. Football was really about relationships. And so is love. Love is a team sport. A team that we are all a part of. And on this team, Daniel's an all-star. But Daniel never had the glory of an end zone dance or even a dance at his junior prom. And that's because his light extinguished way too early. One night during Daniel's junior year in February, he was rolling up the mats with his wrestling buddies and he collapsed in pain. Daniel suffered an aortic aneurysm and he died early the next morning in the hospital. It was tragic. The date was February 7th, 2002. Exactly 12 years ago today, I don't think it's any coincidence that I'm here today with the opportunity to share Daniel's story with you. Daniel is my lighthouse. When the water is dark and dangerous, the lighthouse can provide a warm and inviting light, almost as if to say, "This way home." Daniel brought me home, literally by bringing me to his home. The night after he died, I visited his family, along with a number of other teachers from our school. We were all greeted by Daniel's cousin, Leah, who thanked us for being there during such a devastating time. I introduced myself as Daniel's theology teacher, and she replied, "Oh, you're the one that Daniel wanted me to marry." It was kind of like a light went on. I ended up sitting with Leah and her mom, sharing stories of Daniel and looking at pictures. It was a really difficult time for us both, but it was hard for me not to notice that Leah had the same passion and energy for life that I saw in Daniel. I wish he could have seen us meet. Riding home that night, I quietly recalled my last moment with Daniel. He was visiting my class. And like many times before, Daniel would just stroll right in. And because I was sitting behind the desk, he came over to me, and we were about the same height, and our shoulders bumped into each other as we talked. I introduced him to the class as a 103-pound wrestler who was having a great season. And the younger guys just kind of looked at him in awe. I mean, here was this guy, smaller than most of them, but he carried so much weight and loving energy. And on his way out of the classroom that morning, Daniel turned over his shoulder in his cool little way and said, "See you around, Mr. Ward." Daniel died early the next morning. A couple weeks later, I thought I saw Daniel at school. A student was sitting with their back to me, and it looked like Daniel. And for a moment, I believed that it was him. But soon the student stood, and it obviously wasn't Daniel. But to me, the message was clear. The same love and light that I witnessed and experienced in Daniel could be found in everyone and everything. And so I began to look for Daniel, to look for love in everyone and everything. And at the crucial point in my life, even in myself, Daniel was right when he said, "See you around." Because the same love in him is within us all. Just as I tell my students back at school, there is so much goodness in you. And you are all, each and every one of you, worthy of love and belonging, just as you are, imperfectly perfect. And once you begin to open yourself to love, you will learn to see it everywhere, creating a peace, a freedom, and a truth that will shift your overall entire experience. Think about it. If I stand right here, and I shift just a little bit, my view changes entirely. Well, the same is true for love. If we can begin to make an effort to love and to be loved without any conditions, we will bring a whole new level of meaning to our relationships and to our experience. I'm going to ask you to close your eyes one more time. Picture the sun. Author Anthony DeMello writes, "Has the sun ever said to the earth, 'You owe me'? Look what happens to a love like that. It lights up the whole sky. Is there somebody in your life that could use a little unconditional love? Picture that person now. Remember the lighthouse. Remember its primary purpose, to help guide sailors and boaters home. Is there somebody in your life that could use a little guidance, a little direction? Picture that person now. And lastly, picture the disco ball. Daniel was free to be himself because he loved himself unconditionally. We could all reflect a little bit of love back home, so that we can dance like nobody's watching. Is there something in your life that you've been waiting to do? Gently float open your eyes and smile. 12 years ago, after Daniel died, I decided to ask his cousin Leah out for dinner in his honor. We had so much to talk about. And I am happy to tell you that 4 years after that, I asked Leah to marry me. She continues to light up my life every day Leah is my sunshine. And now we have two sons. Our oldest is almost three, and his name is John Daniel, who we affectionately call JD. And he's our little disco ball. We also have another son who's just 12 weeks old now. His name is Casey Christian, and he's our little lighthouse. When people ask Leah if the boys will play football in the NFL someday like their daddy did, she says, maybe. But our only wish for them is to truly live a life where they can love and be loved. Thank you very much.
What was Venice Beach before?
So this has been what I've dedicated my life to. There are 900,000 divorces in the United States of America every year. Fewer than 10% of them ever talk to anybody about their relationship. So why would you need a science? Well, we need a science to develop effective treatment and understanding of how to make love work. Why? Why should we care about having great relationships? Well, it turns out that in the past 50 years, a field called social epidemiology has...
Care that goes where you go. That's International Travel Insurance through NHP. We facilitate cover of up to 10 million Namibian dollars per member for medical emergencies abroad as part of your membership. No extra charge. To receive your policy within minutes, simply register at nhp.com.na before you travel. T's and C's apply. NHP, rooted in care for you.
Your health, your life, your peace of mind. NHP, we're about you.
Want to know?
Emerged, and it shows that great friendships, great love relationships between lovers and parents and children lead to greater health, mental health, as well as physical health, greater wealth, greater resilience, faster recovery from illness, greater longevity. If you want to live 10 to 15 years longer, work on your relationships, not just your exercise, and more successful children as well. So love has a kind of magic. It's able to do amazing things. And one of my favorite films is Sleepless in Seattle with Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan. And I just want to share with you a quote where Tom Hanks is on the radio with the talk show host, Marsha. And she says to him, "Sam, tell me what was so special about your wife." And Tom Hanks, as Sam, says, "Well, how long is your program?" "Oh, well, it was a million tiny little things. We were supposed to be together, and I knew it. I knew it the very first time I touched her. It was like coming home, only to no home I'd ever known. It was just taking her hand to help her out of the car. And, you know, it was like magic." And Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan say the word magic at the same time. So what about this magic? Can science really help find the magic of love? Well, the first step is that we needed a lot of data. We needed to basically understand relationships better. And that's not something I did alone. In fact, 45 years ago, we built a love lab. And this lab was built in part by a bromance. My best friend, Bob Levinson, and I created this lab. And Bob and I became good friends, and we realized that our relationships with women were not going very well. It went from one disaster to another. So basically, two clueless guys got together to build this laboratory. And then, over 30 years ago, a romance with my wife, Dr. Julie Schwartz-Gottman, and we decided to work together to see whether we could make a difference. So basic research was followed by applied research. Now, we use validated questionnaires, online questionnaires that allow us to assess the strengths of the relationship and the areas that need improvement. And we validated these questionnaires to make sure that we knew what we were measuring and we could measure things reliably and accurately. So we created this checkup, and over 40,000 couples have taken these questionnaires, and we get a green circle for a strength, a red box for an area that needs improvement. But we get their story of their relationship. We ask them about how they met. We find out the quality of their friendship and intimacy from this interview. And we collect physiological measures from them as they're talking to one another. We're measuring heart rate, blood velocity, skin conductance, respiration, a variety of things like that. And we score their emotions second by second in this kind of split-screen arrangement where even though they're facing each other, we can really code facial expressions, voice tone, nonverbal behavior, and verbal behavior very accurately and reliably. We have them use a video recall rating dial, which they just turn from extremely negative to extremely positive as they're watching the videotapes to get their perception of the interaction as well. And then we synchronize all of that, video, physiology, coded emotion, and perception. And on the left, you see all the physiological measures we're collecting. And, you know, a cursor that moves along. And this particular moment, you know, the wife has said something that just makes the husband dissolve in hilarity. And shared humor turns out to be very powerful in a relationship at reducing physiological arousal. So what did we find from this laboratory? We got over 90% success in predicting either divorce or stability or the happiness of relationships that were stable. And the major impact of that finding was that Julie and I didn't get invited out to dinner very often. But the effects replicated six different times in six studies that Bob Levinson and I did over the whole life course. And that's probably the most replicated effect in the study of relationships now. And we're no longer alone. Other labs are getting very similar kinds of results. We followed these couples for as long as 20 years. Straight couples, gay and lesbian couples, newlyweds, middle-aged couples, older couples, into their late 80s and 90s. So what do we find? This over 90% prediction. What predicts? And we kind of sit down in our lab and talk to a couple about their strengths and areas that need improvement based upon this research. Well, one thing we do is we create kind of a Dow Jones industrial average of a conversation. And by doing that, very much like the Dow Jones, it's really good if the cumulative positive minus negative emotions are going up. In other words, on the left, we see a low-risk couple where you know, there really is much more positive than negative in general, right? They go up and down. And on the right, the high-risk couple, where basically they go down all along their interaction. Well, it turns out that one thing we discovered was that the way the conversation starts in the first 3 minutes of a conflict discussion will predict 96% of the time whether they're a low-risk couple or high-risk couple. So startup, the way each person starts before they start influencing one another, is very critical in this prediction. The other thing we learned is something we call the Roach Hotel model of relationships. Remember the Roach Hotel? The roaches check in, but they don't check out. That's a really good roach trap. Well, negative emotions, anger, sadness, disappointment, fear, all of these emotions, the negative emotions, for unhappy couples, become like that Roach Hotel. Once they check in, they don't check out. It's hard to exit and easy to enter this negative affect state. And it turned out the balance of positive and negative emotions is our key index of this magic that Tom Hanks was talking about in Sleepless in Seattle. The balance of positive and negative emotions. So this ratio of positivity to negativity during conflict in unhappy couples, that's why this slide is in red, was 0.8 to 1. Just a little bit more negativity than positivity. And I was completely wrong. I thought that would be a great relationship. You know, in my relationships, you know, that had failed, we were much more negative than positive. So I thought if it was balanced, it would be great. But no, it turned out that actually the balance of positive and negative emotions during conflict in relationships that were stable and happy was 5 to 1. It was 5 times as much affection, humor, interest in one another, excitement, connection, then there was hostility, disappointment, anger, negativity. So there really was a balance that was way balanced toward positive emotions in happy, stable relationships. So this 5-to-1 positive to negative ratio has become pretty widely known. I left the Starbucks in Seattle recently, and a guy drove by in his pickup truck, and he rolled down the window, and he said, "Hey, 5-to-1, right?" I said, "Right." So we both gave us the thumbs up sign. So that's our index of the magic. But then we thought, okay, you have an index, but how do you change that index? What do you need to really make a difference? And so our hypothesis was that you needed three things: physiological calm and trust and commitment. So what about those things? Can we actually measure those in our laboratory? And can we actually make a difference? And is this right? Well, the first one, physiological calm, was kind of a balance in physiology. The couples whose heart rates were lower, whose blood was flowing less rapidly, who weren't sweating as much, those people actually seemed kind of boring, but they had great relationships. They were gentle with one another, not hostile. They reassured one another. Very interesting balance in physiology created by their behavior. And by the way, we found we have to measure these things. So I have a pulse oximeter right here, and it allows me, when I press the button, to really find out what my heart rate is and what the percent oxygen is. And right now my heart rate is 110 beats a minute, and my percent oxygen is 92%. So that sucks. I'm highly aroused physiologically. So you can't tell what's going on physiologically with somebody by looking at them. You have to actually measure it. And we have to build physiological calm in a couple. Now, why? Why is that so important? Well, it turns out that when people are calm, they can take in information. They can listen. They can be empathetic. They have access to their sense of humor. That's very important. But when they're flooded, when there's a diffuse activation of various parts of the autonomic nervous system, they're much more likely to be in attack or defend mode, right? So if a therapist doesn't know what's going on physiologically and says, "Can you summarize what your wife just said? Summarize what your husband just says? Can you validate and be empathetic?" They can't do it if they're physiologically aroused, right? So the therapist actually has to know that to help them calm down. So physiological calm is good. That's what we learned. So part of that trio of variables, we know we have validation that that's important. But the magic also comes, we hypothesize, from building trust. So what's trust? It's something that people talk about, but can you measure it? And it turns out we can measure it reliably and validly. And a trusting relationship, a mutually trusting relationship, really leads to intimacy and great sex. A distrusting relationship leads to loneliness. And guess what? The major reason people have affairs is not because of sex or desire. It's because they're lonely and they have found somebody who finds them interesting and wants to talk to them in the context of a relationship that really isn't working very well. So what is trust? How do we define it? How do we measure it? And here we use mathematics, the mathematics of game theory, and we can actually measure this idea that mutual trust comes from when both partners are maximizing the benefits of both people, not just one person's benefit against the other person. So I'm always thinking about, how does my wife see things? I can walk into a kitchen now after 30 years of marriage and view that kitchen the way my wife would do it. So I can say, Julie would be upset by that. So I'll clean it up, and well, now I know when she comes in, she's not going to notice anything that's really disgusting. You know, I'm more of a slob. So, you know, for me, it was fine. You know, but, you know, people who develop mutual trust are really always have their partners in their heads, not just themselves. And they're thinking about both of them. But the magic also comes from building commitment. So what does this mean? Well, we've learned a lot about commitment from the systematic research of a woman named Carol Rusbault and another woman named Shirley Glass. And what we've learned is that in relationships, there is a turning point, a key turning point. When things aren't going well, when your partner is hostile or irritable or emotionally distant, if you really, in your own head, are cherishing your partner and nurturing gratitude for what you have and saying, this is my journey. Julie is the love of my life, and I'm damn lucky to have this person in my life. That turning point leads to loyalty. On the other hand, betrayal comes from really, at that point when things aren't going well, making negative comparisons between your partner and real or imagined alternatives. Betrayal leads to disillusion very reliably, whereas commitment leads to loyalty. And then when you have that sense of commitment in a relationship, both of you have that, you really have a safe place. You have that magic. And with over 90% prediction, with these basic variables, the mechanism by which relationships work, trust, physiological calm, and commitment, can we actually create a mathematics of love? Now, why would you want to create mathematics and love? Why do you want to put math and love together? Some people think that's really disgusting. Well, if you can create a mathematics, you really will understand not just the static nature of commitment, trust, and physiological calm affecting a relationship and creating the magic. You actually will understand the dynamics of the interaction as it unfolds over time. And that's what therapists are working with, right? In their offices, they're looking at how people interact, and they want to influence the dynamic. So we need a dynamic analysis of data over time. What pushes the interaction in one direction versus another? So because we get data over time, we get behavior, perception, and physiology all integrated over time, very much like that Dow Jones Industrial Average, we could create the Gottman-Murray love equations. And so James Murray, who is the father of mathematical biology, and I worked together. And because we're not very intelligent, it took us 15 years to get these equations. But when you look at them, you'll see they're obvious. So what we're trying to do is predict what happens at time T plus one in this graph of the husband's interaction, the wife's interaction. And by the way, this holds for a same-sex couple as well. We say wife and husband only because it's a little bit more convenient to talk about it. But can we go for what's happening in this graph of behavior or physiology or perception at one time and predict at a later time? And in fact, we can develop these equations. So on the left of the equal sign, we see the wife at time T plus one in the equation above. And on the bottom, the husband's. So how do we predict what's going to happen next? That's what we want to know. That's what the therapist wants to know. Well, we have one parameter, and it's denoted A and B, and that's the old startup, right? How they start the conversation before they start influencing one another is really critical. And so that's the theory, that the way they start up, the way the wife starts up, that one constant is very, very important in predicting what's going to happen next. But then there's another parameter, which is R1 and R2, and that predicts how much emotional inertia a person has. So some people, when they get angry, boy, they stay angry a long time. It's hard to move them. They're kind of like a Mack truck going downhill. And in physics, that's called inertia, right? It takes a lot of energy to move them off course. Other people are more like a feather in the wind. They have low inertia, right? Well, they have no stability either. So what's the right inertia? Well, we don't know, but that's another parameter, their emotional inertia. That affects how much influence the partner can have, which is our third parameter, the influence function. So in the wife's equation, there's the husband. And the husband's equation, there's the wife. Well, we can actually specify with a theory what that influence function might look like. So here's the husband along the horizontal axis, and the vertical axis is his influence on the wife. So there are some points, but we need a theory that helps us find the best fit to the data, right? So our theory really said, well, maybe it looks like this. There's one part of it when he's being positive, he's being nice to her. What's the impact of that? The steepness of the slope, T tells us what the impact of positive emotions are, like affection, humor. And then the other one is, how influential is he with negativity, with anger, disappointment, with hurt feelings, with sadness? And that slope gives us our idea of the influence that positive and negative emotions have. But then we thought, well, maybe when they get to a certain threshold that we have denoted by K/R, maybe what happens is they can repair. And so that other part of the curve tells us, when does repair cut in and how effective it is? And what we discover is that if you repair early in the conversation, you're much more effective than if you wait. Okay, that was kind of a surprising finding. And on the other hand, what about positive affect? Maybe you can amplify or diminish positive affect. And it turns out, yes, you can, by turning toward your partner. When your partner needs your attention or interest, the positive affect can be either, you know, by turning away, diminished, or by turning toward, amplified. So these are the parameters in our theory. But now we do a very cool thing. We actually can create a portrait of the couple's interaction, a dynamic portrait of how it unfolds over time. And what we do is we put the husband's positive and negative behavior on the horizontal axis and the wife's on the vertical axis. Going up is positive, going down is negative. That gives us quadrants, 1, 2, 3, and 4. And we can describe that by two bunnies on the beach in quadrant labeled 1 and two bunnies in a storm in quadrant 3. So we really want our couples to be two bunnies on the beach rather than two bunnies in a storm. So it gives us a new goal of couples therapy, right? All right, so this space-based portrait becomes very clear. This quadrant 1 is when they're both positive, and we have another quadrant where they're both negative. So we'd like them to really not spend much time in that quadrant, or this quadrant's where one of them is positive and the other is negative. Although it might be good to be there, because maybe one counterbalances the other. So we don't know yet. So we have those quadrants to look at as well. Okay. There's our relationship phase space. Now, let's look at an actual conversation and see how it unfolds. And there's a dot moving as the couple talks to one another. This is a real conflict conversation a couple is having. And look at that dot moving all over those quadrants in phase space. So now we see there's a dynamic unfolding, but it's kind of hard to see that thing jumping all over the place and know what's good and what's bad. We need the equations, and we need to know what's making that dot move. What's actually compelling that dot to move? Is there some attractive force, kind of like gravitation? Is there an attractive force that has maybe the power of Jupiter to pull them toward the negative attractor, in which case the relationship would be in a lot of trouble? Or is there a positive attractor that puts them in quadrant 1 that is powerful? Or is it weak and the therapist really needs to help make that much more powerful? So here's our old friend, the startup. Now, this couple is starting in a positive place, right? They're in quadrant number 1, the positive, positive quadrant. And there's a choice here. They either move in that direction toward that star, that blue star, which is the attractor in the phase space that pulls their interaction toward a positive place, especially if it's strong. Or they might move the other way. They might actually cycle around another attractor that's there that moves them in the negative, negative quadrant. And that's our bunnies in a storm. And we don't want them there. Or we don't want them to spend very much occupation time in that place. And the attractors are the forces that make the dot move. So we're looking at not just a graph and phase space, but we're looking at a flow diagram, almost like a fluid flowing. And you've seen this kind of phase space diagram with hurricanes. Hurricane Irma, this comes from that hurricane where the dot is moving, right? And there's a force moving it toward an attractor up there. And we can actually do the same thing with a couple's interaction. So, okay, that's a theory for getting a dynamical picture. Does it work? Well, this is what a stable, unhappy marriage looks like. Look at all the flows. Look at the arrows. And what are they flowing toward? A negative attractor for our bunnies in a storm, right? We don't like that, you know. And, well, what about divorced couples? Well, it turns out with divorced couples, you get this picture. There are three attractors in that negative-negative quadrant. And one is unstable. The one between the two stars and the two stars are unstable. So what we get there is turbulence. Not only is there flow toward the negative-negative quadrant, but a lot of energy is expended as they move from one attractor to the other. That turbulence is probably what predicts divorce versus being in a stable, unhappy marriage. Now, I don't know which is worse, but they are different. But the real test is, what about good relationships, happy, stable relationships? How do they look? And it turns out when you put this together with real data, you get this picture. So, yes, it's true. Happy, stable relationships have a positive attractor. Very, very simple face-based diagram. And no matter where they start the conversation, where that startup is, they'll go toward a positive place, which is kind of amazing. That's the dynamics of a good relationship. So we did it. We actually were able to describe mathematically the dynamics. Now, here's another thing you can do with the math. With the math, we can simulate any couple under imagined conditions. In other words, we can do thought experiments. We can do experiments by changing the parameters, and mathematically, we can select the best intervention to help a couple just using math. So, for example, here's a couple, and what you see on the left are these sliders where we can change every parameter in the math equation, right? We can change their startup, we can change their emotional inertia, we can change their repair threshold, how much they repair, when they repair. And here we see, you know, the green lines that show us the influence functions and the arrows that show us the face-based portrait, the flow. So let's take a look at an actual couple. And here we see our two bunnies in the storm. They have that negative attractor. And we can actually move the sliders to say, what would they look like if their startup was just more positive? So we move, in this thought experiment, we move the couple to a more positive place by changing those parameters to startup. And then we take a look at what the result is of the math. And look, there are two bunnies on the beach. They're in that positive-positive quadrant. And then all we need is a technology for changing startup, which we have. So we've created the technology for changing these parameters, and now the therapist can change their startups. And then they get the magic. Research findings are that the magic does require this powerful trio of physiological calm, trust, and commitment, and we know how to build it. So science did it. When the magic is there, we find that we get that 5-to-1 ratio. Now we can understand the magic, because with a positive attractor, no matter where their conversation begins, it will be drawn to the positive-positive quadrant. We'll get the 5-to-1 ratio. Yahoo, there's the magic. Okay, so just to summarize, what we've really said is love relationships are important. We can assess their strengths and challenges scientifically. There is magic in love that lasts forever. We know that. And the 5-to-1 ratio indexes it. We have strong prediction, but we can mathematically model the magic. The magic requires calm, trust, and commitment. And maybe we can help avoid disaster and help couples find their magic, which is turning out to be true in randomized clinical trials. So perhaps now the magic of great love is a bit less of a mystery. Thank you.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We're listening to the experts talk about love. They're talking about love. And I feel that it is very important for us to actually listen to these conversations, to hear what they have to say, you know? And so we said that there are different types of love, right? The ancient Greeks, said that the types of love that they had was agape, eros, philia, storge, ludus, pragma, and philautia. All right. Those were the different types of love. And then in modern psychology, they say that there are different types of love as well, which is liking, infatuation, empty love, romantic love, compassionate love, fetus love, and consummate love. Those are the different types of love that psychology today dictates that we as individuals have. And then there are also types, other types of love. And I think that this is more like on a deeper level, where it is mania love. And you know, when you hear mania, you know where it's going, you know, mania love. So it's obsessive, jealous and possessive love rooted in insecurities. And then we have xenia, guest love or hospitality love, thoughtful love, consideration love, and primary type of love, you know, today. So we, it's the kind of love that we also dish out a lot to people that, they're generous to us. So we just love them. You're like, oh, you know, I love the Grim Reaper. Why? Why do you love the Grim Reaper? I don't know, man. He kinda just saved my life. Really? Were you on the receiving end? Or how did you guys get to that point? But we are most not asking questions about the Grim Reaper. It is what it is. So, ladies and gentlemen, mostly today we're going to be diving into the world of those that have been experts. The number in studio is 083-288-401. That is the number in studio. When you stumble upon something that is enticing to you, when you stumble upon something that's like making sense, maybe, just maybe, right? We can discuss. So please do call in. And the next conversation we're going to be having or listening to is whether it is biology or it's fate, whether it's science, love, or sex, or attachment. What is it exactly? So, ladies and gentlemen, today is going to be a handful. So it's one of those conversations where you should actually brace yourself and then also sit and take a few notes, and then we'll come back to discuss as we dive a little bit deeper into this love thing. Because many of us dish out the term, I love you, I love you, I love that cake, I love that icing, I love the aircon, I love everything. You just love it. So at least if we can pinpoint it and make the correct judgment on who and what we are doing, then maybe it would be much better. And another disclaimer, we as Eagle Media House, Eagle FM, does not claim any ownerships of the clips that we play during Pulling Heartstrings. This is strictly for illustration purposes, for learning purposes, and for exposure purposes, so that we can also share what we know, and as those that know also shared with us.
I'm Dr. Helen Fisher. I'm a biological anthropologist, and I study love. I've written 6 books that sell all over the world on romantic love, where how it evolved, what happens in the brain, why you fall in love with one person rather than another.
Chapter 1, A Life Shaped by Love and Curiosity.
I really had a wonderful childhood. I grew up in a modern house, a glass house, right next to Philip Johnson's glass house in New Canaan, Connecticut. And it was thrilling. We had a lot of land. We had big floodlights. You could see the deer and the foxes and the woodchucks and the possums all around the house all the time. I have an identical twin sister, so I always had somebody to play with. And my father and mother really believed that sex was an important part of a partnership. As a matter of fact, when I was 18, my father gave me about 20 books on sex. There was nothing prurient in our household. I never even saw him hold my hand. He was an executive at Time Magazine. He was a good friend of Henry R. Luce. He commuted to New York every day. And I just played with my twin sister and went to school, was sent off to boarding school, certainly went to college, actually several of them, and then got into graduate school at the University of Colorado in Boulder. and got my PhD in physical anthropology and human evolution. And then I focused on the brain and romantic love and attachment. Why we bother to pair up with somebody at all? 97% of mammals don't do that. It's very unusual that we love the way we do and we stick with one partner for periods of time. I remember my first sexual experience. You'll probably be disappointed, but my father loved to fish and my mother collected a lot of driftwood for her flower arrangements. And we went up to Cape Cod and it was in the autumn and we were playing on the beach, way, way up the beach. And I was about 5 years old and my father, who was a very good tennis player, gave me a tennis ball and he put his big watch on my wrist. And he said, you girls go up around that huge sand escarpment and don't come back and don't look back until this hand is here and that hand is there. So off we shuffled up the beach. We followed the instructions and we came back when we were told to. And my mother was entirely different. She's generally a bit of a battle axe. And she was right next to my father. They were both sitting on this tiny little towel and she was so charming. And I looked down to her and I said, something's going on here. I don't know what it is, but I know it's good for me. And that was the beginning. Sex was always a part of my family's life. I remember that on Saturday afternoon, my twin sister were instructed to never walk around that side of the house because it was a glass house and you could see in. And we were never allowed to knock on their bedroom door if, in fact, it was shut. So for some reason, sex was all around. I remember one time, very young child, and I walked out of a restaurant and Dad and Mother were standing out there waiting for the car. And I saw him reach and pat her on the fanny. It was somehow always around. And I was also told that this was an important part of a partnership. I knew from a small child that when I grew up, there were certain things in a partnership that really should work properly. And one was you should find your partner sexually attractive. And so, I mean, a lot of people have thought, oh, this is disgusting. It was just the way I grew up. And I've always thought that sex was an important part of romance. It is. They're very closely connected now. I've shown that in the brain. I'm happy to tell you why sex is good for you if you want to hear about it. I am an identical twin. And I've always gotten along absolutely perfectly with my twin sister. Her name is Lorna. She lives in France. She's a very fine painter. And she shows in Paris and actually also in China and Japan. She's a fine painter. We've never had an argument. And one thing about being an identical twin is everybody asks you about yourself. Everybody does. Do you have the same cavities in your teeth? Do you like the same food? Do you have the same friends? Everybody does. And one time we were maybe around 8 or 9 and we were told to assemble in the foyer of our house when one of mother's friends came over. And the mother's friend came over and she leaned down to me and she said, ask the standard questions. And then she said, do you think alike? And at the time I thought to myself as I looked up at her, well, how would I know how she thinks? I mean, that's ridiculous. But I came to realize that there are patterns to personality that are genetically related. And so when I got to graduate school in Boulder, it was a long time ago. And in those days, they thought that the mind was an empty slate, a tabula rasa. In environment just filled up the brain with who you are. And as I sit there and listen to these various academics, I thought, that's not true. There's got to be some part of our mind that came out of our nature. I know that because I'm in a twin, an identical twin. And so when it came to writing my PhD dissertation, I thought to myself, if there's any part of human behavior that has a biological origin, it must be our patterns of love and marriage. Because as Darwin would have said, if you have 4 children and I have no children, you live on and I die out. The game of love matters. And so you would think there would have been selection for all kinds of behaviors that would enable you to fall in love with somebody, form a partnership, and raise your babies as a team. And so that's why I started to study love. And you know, people will often think, well, she studied love because she had a bad relationship in high school. Well, nobody gets out of love alive. We all have problems with love, but that did not stimulate me to study romantic love. It was simply because I was an identical twin, and I was absolutely positive that if there was any part of human behavior that must have evolved, that must have a genetic and physiological component, it's who we love, who we choose, how we partner, and how we raise our babies as a team. I was a very curious child. I remember we lived in a small town in Connecticut, but my family comes from New York City. And I remember taking the train home at night and just glued out the window into everybody's home looking for anything about them. And because we grew up in a glass house and because there were three other glass houses on this lane, we were at the top of the lane, I used to, as a small child, sneak into the woods and sit on an old stone wall and just watch my neighbors eat dinner. And then when I got to graduate school, I remember being invited to a party, and they had a telescope. And they had the telescope focused on somebody in another apartment building. It happened to be a man watching television and smoking a pipe. And while everybody was carousing, I just sat there and I watched for, I don't know, 45 minutes. I just watched this man smoke his pipe. Just the way the face moved, the way his expressions were, what he was wearing, what I've always been interested in human beings, and particularly in human nature. When I first began to study romantic love, I wrote my very first academic paper, and it was on these three different brain systems that I think evolved for mating and reproduction, sex drive being one, feelings of intense romantic love being the second, and feelings of deep attachment being the third. And I was maintaining in that article that these all evolved for various reasons. And I sent in that paper to a very good journal, and the peer reviews came back, and maybe two, but at least one of the peer reviewers wrote back and said, "You can't study this. It's part of the supernatural." And I looked at that and I thought to myself, does this person think that anger is part of the supernatural, that fear is part of the supernatural, that disgust or joy is part of the supernatural? Why would they think that romantic love, a basic brain system, would be part of the supernatural? I mean, all over the world, you know, we've got data on over 200 societies. People everywhere fall in love. They pine for love. They live for love. They kill for love. And they die for love. It's a powerful brain system. And then you take a look at all the myths, the legends, and in more advanced societies, the plays, the operas, the symphonies, the ballets, the movies, the self-help books, the Valentine's Day cards, letters, therapists. We are deluged with this basic human drive to love.
Chapter 2. Love is a drive, not a feeling.
I really began by wondering why we bother to pair up at all. 97% of mammals do not pair up. People do. So I thought that might be quite easy. And I looked at the demographic yearbooks of the United Nations and in every culture in the world, and not only around the world today, but historically, traditional societies, hunting and gathering societies, every single culture in the world has some mechanism for people to form some sort of partnership to rear their babies as a team. And so I really started by looking at the demographic yearbooks of the United Nations, reading over 90 ethnographic studies of hunter-gatherers and agrarian peoples and herding peoples, etc. And I just kept seeing the same pattern, no matter what their gods were, what they did for a living, what they wore, the songs they sang. Everything varies except love. And everybody loves. So I became convinced that this was a real thing, that we were built somehow to form partnerships. And then the day came when I thought to myself, well, then it must be something in the brain. And I remember I was walking along in Greenwich Village. It was about 3 o'clock on a weekday afternoon. And I suddenly thought to myself, these three brain systems must have evolved. Sex drive, feelings of intense romantic love, and feelings of attachment. I remember even where I was standing, and I thought, maybe if I could put people into a brain scanner, I could find the basic brain pathways, the basic brain circuitry of these three basic brain systems. A lot of people have studied the sex drive. I didn't need to study that. We know some of the genes. We know some of the hormones. We know the pathways, really. I mean, to some extent, certainly, but quite a bit about the sex drive. So I felt that it was more important for me to study romantic love and feelings of attachment. And I focused on romantic love because people really do think it's part of the supernatural. Most people don't kill themselves over an attachment. They kill themselves over romantic love. I mean, it is such a powerful brain system that I thought to myself, if I can figure out what's happening in the brain, maybe I can help people understand this and, in fact, maybe not even kill themselves when they are rejected. Nobody gets out of love alive. We all suffer. Some people suffer more than others. Some people respond very dramatically, and some people can get over it relatively quickly. But nobody gets out of love alive. We all have disappointments. It's such a powerful brain system. I mean, everywhere in the world. It's very interesting because, you know, I was talking to a man who, an anthropologist who studies the people in China. This was many years ago. And he said, oh, well, the Chinese don't love. Well, he didn't read any of their love poetry. Everywhere in the world, there's poetry and songs and dances and dramas that express love. So he went back to China and he said to his assistant, who was Chinese, he said, well, I mean, in China, they don't love. And the assistant broke down, started crying and said, I have a woman who doesn't love me. I don't know what I'm going to do. And that sent him on to studying romantic love in China. And when you look around the world, I mean, the poetry, you know, a lot of anthropologists study potsherds or post holes or arrowheads or all kinds of more sophisticated things. But I really like to read poetry because I think it's a basic artifact of this basic brain system. And it always says the same thing. I remember one poet by a Chinese person, and it was something like this. It was something like, you know, I cannot bear to put away the bamboo sleeping mat. The night I brought you home, I watched you roll it out. Even the things that a lover touches in your house acquire meaning. The brain acquires meaning to anything that has to do with romance and attachment. It's so profoundly basic to who we are, because if you don't love and you don't attach, you don't have babies, and you don't send your DNA into tomorrow, and from a Darwinian perspective, you lose. It's very interesting. People don't think that other animals love. I've really looked at a lot of other animals, and they do love. They do form romantic. I call it animal magnetism or animal romance. And you can see a rat suddenly feel a very intense interest in another rat. It only lasts for about 30 seconds. In elephants, it lasts for about 5 days. In foxes, it can last a long time. But most other animals don't form a partnership. They feel that intense attraction, animal magnetism. And we now know that that attraction is basically the same brain system as our brain system of feelings of romantic love. So other animals love. Darwin said that other animals love. He even thought that butterflies felt that attraction and that this was sort of a primordial beginning of this attraction system that became incredibly elaborate in the human animal. But why is it that we bother to pair up? All kinds of other animals feel romance, but it doesn't last very long. In humans, it can last months or years, actually. We've been able to prove that romantic love can last many years. I think that the brain circuitry for human romantic love and feelings of deep attachment evolved probably 4.4 million years ago. Our ancestors were being forced out of the trees. They were going to have to come down onto the ground because the trees were disappearing and move through very dangerous open grasslands to another group of trees and collect what they could on the ground before they went to eat in a place unmolested by predators. And with the beginning of carrying sticks and stones to protect themselves and food to eat, they began to have to walk on two legs instead of four. Chimpanzees walk on four legs and they've got their baby on their back. We began to have to walk up on two legs instead of four, which meant that females began to have to carry their babies in their arms instead of on their backs. Now, how is a 4 million year old female going to have to carry the equivalent of a 20-pound bowling ball in one arm and sticks and stones in the other and protect and feed herself. She began to need a partner to help protect her while she moved along. And how could a male 4 million years ago protect a whole group of females? He could protect one. And so we went over what I call the monogamy threshold, a threshold so in which the female needed a partner to help her raise her baby, at least through infancy, and males needed to protect at least one female with his DNA in her. And of course, females needed a male who wanted to stick around. Those that didn't stick around didn't have the babies and didn't pass their DNA onto you and me, leaving in the human creature today both men and women with a tremendous capacity to fall in love, form a partnership, and raise their children as a team. So the bottom line is, along with that, we began to evolve our human brain pathways for human romantic love and feelings of deep attachment. So I began to believe that if I looked into the brain, I could find the brain circuitry of romantic love. So I assembled a team and began to put people in the scanner. And the issue was how to scan the brain. And what I ended up with is the following protocol or research design. They would look at a picture of their sweetheart that called forth the wonderful feelings of romantic love. And they would also look at a photograph of somebody who called forth no emotions, no positive or negative emotions. The problem with that is when you're madly in love with somebody, your emotions are going to bleed from one picture to the other. So I had to relax the brain between looking at the neutral, the positive, and the neutral. So I used a very standard psychological distraction task. I would cast on the screen a large number like 4,821, and I would ask them for 30 seconds to look at that photograph, that picture, and that number, and count backwards in increments of 7. Now, even mathematicians take some time to count backwards in increments of 7. It takes all the blood away from brain regions linked with romantic love to brain regions linked with just simply counting backwards. So this way, they would bring a photograph of their sweetheart into the lab. They would bring a neutral photograph, somebody from the office who they barely knew, somebody from the dry cleaners, some past friend of somebody who called forth no positive or negative feelings. So they would look at those two photographs. They would look at their sweetheart. Then they would count backwards. Then they would look at the neutral. Then they would count backwards. So it was positive, count back, neutral, count back. A cycle of 6 times, 12 times looking at these photographs. That way, we were able to capture through the fMRI machine how you felt when you experienced that intense feeling of romantic love, what you were doing in the brain when you were counting backwards, and how you felt when you were simply looking at the neutral photograph. And when you put the neutral and the romantic love on top of each other and cancel out what you they have in common, you're left what's going on in the brain when you're madly in love. I'll never forget the first moment that I looked at our data. I felt as if I was looking back to over 4 million years ago when this brain system evolved. And what we saw was activity in a tiny little factory near the base of the brain called the ventral tegmental area. It's a brain region that actually makes dopamine, a natural stimulant, and gives you that focus, that motivation, the craving, the elation of intense romantic love. And in fact, I was really surprised. I thought we would find all kinds of data, linked with the emotions and linked with cognitive thinking process. We did find data linked with thinking processes and the emotions, but no two people were alike, which is obvious. They'd be thinking about somebody else. But they all showed activity in this little factory near the base of the brain. And I had thought that romantic love was an emotion or a series of emotions, but what it really is a drive, a basic mating drive that evolved millions of years ago to enable you to focus your mating energy on a single individual and start the mating process. As a matter of fact, we now call it a survival mechanism. The basic brain region that generates the dopamine and gives you that feeling of romantic love lies right next to the factory that orchestrates thirst and hunger. Thirst and hunger keep you alive today. Romantic love enables you to focus your mating energy and drive your DNA into tomorrow. So it's a basic survival mechanism that evolved millions of years ago, came out of nature, came out of other animals that feel it, but nowhere near to that degree. As a matter of fact, I think all three of these brain systems evolved in tandem. The sex drive evolved to get you out there looking for a whole range of partners. I mean, you can have sex with somebody when you're not in love with them. Romantic love evolved to enable you to focus your mating energy on just one at a time. And attachment, that third brain system, evolved to enable you to stick with this person at least long enough to raise a single child through infancy. I was absolutely positive it was not a supernatural event. And so, no, I did not think about that person at that moment. But I have been determined to show the world that this is real. So many people suffer from it. And as a matter of fact, you know, a lot of people came and wanted to talk to me, a lot of journalists, et cetera, after we discovered this data. And I thought to myself at the time, you know, Helen, this really isn't very important. You know, when you're madly in love with the right person, there's no problem. The real problem is when you've been rejected in love. That's when you turn into a pest, not only for all your friends and family, but you can, it's a dangerous situation. So I thought to myself, now what I've got to do is put people into the machine who've been rejected in love. That's where I can make a contribution to humanity. Well, then my next study was putting people into the brain scanner who had just been rejected in love. That was a lot harder because, you know, Before I put people in this brain scanner, you really talk to them for a long time. You've got to make sure that they are madly in love or that they are rejected in love because these machines are expensive and it's extremely time consuming. So, and I also have to tell them what's going to go on in the machine. I've got to get them to bring me the correct pictures so it triggers the right response in the brain. So I have long discussions with all of our subjects, our participants before I put them in the machine. And, when you've been rejected in love, one girl didn't show up for the scanning. She had not been out of bed for almost 4 days. Another person cried so hard in the machine that we couldn't use the data. She moved too much. Another person, after the scanning, came out of the machine and was so angry that he went home and, you know, drank too much. And so I began to realize very early, now I'm playing with something that is so powerful that I began to make sure that I walk with them for a while after the scan was over, that I called them that evening and the following morning to make sure that everything was all right. This is when people kill themselves. This is when people kill somebody else. This is when they stalk. This is when they cry all night. This is when they slip into clinical depression. So I thought it was an extremely important study. I still think it is. And I was determined to see whether rejection in love was actually an addiction. I had even thought that happy love was an addiction because, you know, when you're madly in love, you'll do the craziest things. And sure enough, I was able to put 15 men and women into the scanner who had just been dumped. I was able to find activity in a lot of brain regions. One brain region is that same basic ventral tegmental area, the VTA, that pumps out the dopamine, that gives them the feeling of intense romantic love. Also found activity in a brain region linked with deep feelings of attachment. You don't stop loving somebody when they've dumped you. I found activity in a brain region linked with pain, with physical pain. This is a brain region that also becomes active when you have a toothache. The difference between a toothache and intense rejection is the toothache goes away after you get to the dentist. And with rejection and love, you can feel that pain for months, maybe sometimes years. But most important, I found activity in three brain regions linked with craving and addiction. Specifically, and what I was looking for, is activity in a brain region called the nucleus accumbens. It's the basic brain region that becomes active when you are addicted to cocaine, heroin, booze, alcohol, cigarettes, gambling, all of the addictions. And so I was able to prove that romantic love, when you are rejected, is an addiction. It is a love addiction. Then we went back and we were able to find that people who were madly and happily in love were also addicted. We also found activity in this basic brain region, the nucleus accumbens. So I'm trying to get the world to understand how important this brain system is. You know, it's so interesting. Some psychologists, you know, you'll go in and they'll say, Well, just get rid of him. You know, he beats you up. Just get rid of him. And they don't really realize that this person might not be able to get rid of them. As a matter of fact, I really believe in many of the principles of AA, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I do think that we need to treat this particular addiction as a very special addiction with very special therapies.
Chapter 3, How to Make Love Last.
I hope the world understands that this intense feeling of romantic love came out of nature. Everybody feels it, and we have to respect the intense feelings of people when they have been rejected in love, when they're happily in love, and when they're in love long term. My colleagues and I have put 17 people into the scanner who were in love long term. These were people all in their 50s and 60s. They kept coming into the lab saying, I'm still in love with her. Not just loving her, in love with her, or in love with him. So we put, I think it was 17 people into the brain scanner using fMRI again, in love an average of 21 years. Americans don't believe that you can remain in love long term. And sure enough, we found activity in these same brain regions. The ventral tegmental area pumps out the dopamine, gives you feelings of intense romantic love. A brain region in the ventral pallidum linked with attachment. A brain region in the hypothalamus linked with the sex drive. And brain regions linked with calm and security. So in long-term love, you can remain in love long-term. But you got to pick the right person. And that's what sent me into wondering, why him? Why her? Why are we so naturally drawn to one person rather than another? I don't think it's just culture. I think there's biology involved. I know that some other scientists are trying to find what's basically love magic. I mean, you know, a great many cultures in the world have some form of love magic. And they are trying to see if we can concoct various drugs that either trigger the brain circuitry of romantic love or remain in love long-term. I don't think that's possible, personally. We do know that when you do novel things together with somebody, you can trigger or sustain feelings of romantic love. The reason being that any kind of novelty drives up the dopamine system in the brain. And that's one of the things that I say to people. If you want to maintain a long-term happy partnership, you want to sustain all three of these brain systems. You want to have sex regularly, that drives up the
At my age, you start appreciating things you might have taken for granted before, like good health. I've known from early on that donating blood regularly was indeed good for my health. I'm too old now, but I've done my part in saving hundreds of lives while benefiting my own. You see, my risk of a heart attack, stroke, and cancer was always low because I donated blood.
Call NHB on 061-285-5400. We're about you.
Testosterone system, so you want more sex. Sex is very good for you if you like the person you're having sex with. If you want to sustain feelings of intense romantic love, novelty, novelty, novelty. And you don't have to swing from chandeliers. Just ride your bicycles going out to dinner. Walk in a different part of town. Go on a summer vacation to someplace else. Do something novel. And if you want to sustain feelings of deep attachment, stay in touch. Any kind of holding hands, kissing, walking arm in arm, sitting next to each other to watch television instead of separate armchairs, learning to at least start sleeping together in one another's arms. Any kind of continued pleasant touch drives up the oxytocin system. So I think what I'm working towards here is understanding these brain circuits enough, sex drive, romantic love, and feelings of attachment, so that we can use the data to find the right person, that's number one, understand who they are, that's number two, and sustain a long-term happy partnerships. The reason being that happy partnerships are important. In a happy partnership, you live longer, you have fewer diseases, any kinds of hugs drives up the oxytocin system, any kind of laughter with the partner drives up the dopamine system, and any kind of play with the partner contributes to brain growth. So it's important to be able to find the right person and then sustain these feelings of the sex drive, romantic love, and attachment. And I hope I'm certainly working that way in my science. I am Chief Science Advisor to Match.com, and I'm going on to my 16th year of that. And I'm a consultant to them, but I'll talk to them again tomorrow. I do it all the time. The first thing I did with them, I'll never forget the moment that they first called me. It was 2 days before Christmas in New York City. Nothing happens in New York City 2 days before Christmas. And I picked up the phone, and somebody said, would you meet with the people at Match 2 days after Christmas? I said, sure. And they offered me some money too, so why not? And I went into this big glass building down on Canal Street and was sitting there in this room, and all of a sudden 11 people poured in. And I didn't know who they were. I thought, is this a think tank? Are there other academics here? And as it turns out, it was the CEO on down. And in the middle of the morning, he turned to me. I didn't know which he was at the time, but somebody had turned to me and ended up being the CEO. And he looked at me and said, Helen, why do you fall in love with one person rather than another? And at the time I said, well, you know, nobody really knows. We tend to fall in love with somebody who's from the same socioeconomic and ethnic background, somebody with the same level of intelligence and good looks and education, somebody with the same reproductive and economic goals, and somebody who shares your social and religious values. But you can walk into a room, and everybody is from your background and level of education and good looks and ethnic background, and you don't fall in love with all of them. And it was at that moment that I thought to myself, there must be some biology to it. There must be something that we've evolved to draw us naturally to some people rather than others. So that was the beginning of looking into the biology of why him, why her, why you fall in love with one person rather than another. I accomplished that within, oh, I don't know, 5-10 years of working with them. And more recently, for the last 10 years, what I do is something else. I work with annually doing a study called Singles in America. And annually with Match, we construct about 200 questions that we want to know about. And then we do a national study. We do not poll the Match members. This is not a study of Match members. It's a national representative sample of singles based on the U.S. Census. So we got the right number of blacks, whites, Asians, Latino, gay, straight, rural, suburban, urban, every part of the country, and every age group, age 18 to 71 plus. So we create about 200 questions, generally in July and August. And then we get the data back in early December. That destroys Christmas for me. And we assemble all the data, and I begin to find the patterns of who we love, how we love, where we love, when we love, what we eat. I know how many orgasms singles have. I know Republicans and Democrats and independents. I mean, I know what gays eat and what straights eat, which, by the way, is exactly the same thing. There's almost no difference between gays and straights except who you're attracted to. I've been trying to tell the press that for, I don't know, 15 years. They can't understand that. These people love. It's a universal feeling, romantic love. And so we collect the data. I look for patterns, and then finally we write a press release, and then we write academic papers on it. We've already written 13 academic papers on it, understanding this huge data set. And it's so interesting. A lot of people have said, oh, well, why do you work with Match? You know, I mean, academics are supposed to stay in academia. Well, I've got data on 50,000 people. That's a real blessing. And indeed, in my personality questionnaire, I made this questionnaire based on brain circuitry. I validated with brain scanning, and it's now been taken by over 15 million people in 40 countries. And this is where business and academia can really work together.
Chapter 4, Love in the Modern Age.
It's very interesting how online dating is affecting love, particularly recently. You know, I've done this study for 10 years now. And as it turns out, more people met their last first date on the internet than off of the internet. So it varies year by year. But let's say 2017, 40% of singles met their last first date on the internet, not just Match, but somewhere on the internet, on a dating site or a dating app, and only 25% met through a friend, and less than 10% met at work, at school, at church, in some sort of social setting. So bottom line is more people meet today on the internet than off the internet. And a very recent article came out of the University of Chicago showing that if you met somebody on the internet rather than off the internet, you were less likely to divorce. And I thought to myself, well, why would that be? I mean, what difference do you meet him in a bar? You meet him in a restaurant? You meet him in a museum? You meet him at work or school? Why would where you meet somebody make a difference in the stability of a partnership? So I did a study with Match, not of Match members, and I looked at people who met somebody on the internet as opposed to off of the internet. And as it turns out, people who met on the internet are more likely to have full-time employment, more likely to be of higher education, and more likely to be looking for a long-term commitment. And so we're seeing the rise of internet dating. And along with that, there's every reason to think we're going to see more stability in partnerships. The other thing that we're seeing is more interracial marriages, which I think is always great. So these are the long-term trends. You can't kill love. It's a basic brain system, like the fear system or the anger system or the joy system. You can't kill it. What it's changing is courtship. You know, in my day, which was a long time ago, somebody picked you up and you went parking. You know, 150 years ago, you went to church and then went off to lunch and swing on the porch and met somebody that way. 50,000 years ago, you assembled at a water hole and you met somebody at the other side of the water hill. So courtship changes from one society and one culture and one time to the next. Courtship will keep changing. Romantic love will be with us forever. It's primordial. It's adaptable and it's eternal. It will survive as long as we survive as a species. Long before the pandemic, I had already seen a very interesting new courtship process, which I call slow love. In the past, people, both men and women, married in their early 20s. Now they're marrying in their late 20s, this very long period of pre-commitment, slow love. They're getting to know each other very slowly. They're starting these days, oh, just friends, we're just friends. Then they move into friends with benefits. You learn a lot between the sheets, not just the way somebody makes love, but whether they are patient, whether they're kind, whether they've got a sense of humor. Then, if that all works out, then they go out on the official first date and tell friends and family about the relationship. And then they slowly move in together, and then they marry. The bottom line is, with this slow love, by the time they walk down the aisle, they know who they've got, they know they want who they've got, and they think they can keep who they've got. As a matter of fact, 89% of singles today do believe that when you find the right person, you can remain married for life. What's interesting about this slow love is that the later you marry, the longer you court, the later you marry, the more likely you are to remain together long-term. I know that because I've studied it through the demographic yearbooks of the United Nations. Everywhere in the world, in 80 societies, and I've got data from 1947 to 2011, it hasn't changed. The later you marry, the more likely you are to remain married. And we now have data on over 3,000 Americans.
You see that? The later you marry, the later you marry, the more likely you are to stay together. So being patient, being patient when it comes to love and marrying one another is important, isn't it? And this is a doctor telling us, okay?
Americans showing that the longer you court and the later you wed, the more likely you are to remain together long term. That is slow love. There's a new stage emerging called video chatting. And they're meeting on the internet, then they're doing the video chatting, and then they're going out and meeting in person. And I have data that is very recent, within about 4 months. And as it turns out, these people who are doing the video chatting are having more meaningful conversations. They're having longer conversations before they meet in person. They're being more honest, more transparent. They're focusing less on their looks and the other person's looks, and they're focusing much more on whether this person is fully employed and is stable economically and financially. So we're seeing the slowing down even more of courtship. And as a matter of fact, what's interesting about this video dating is I did a study of almost 1,000 people who are doing the video dating right this minute, and it keeps increasing. 50% of them actually fell in love during their video chatting, and 56% of them reported that they felt some romantic feelings for somebody. So when you look at them, even if it's through a video camera, you can trigger this brain circuitry and fall in love. You know, romantic love, I think, is like a sleeping cat. It can be awakened instantly. And indeed, it's doing it on video chatting. So we're going to see more meaningful first dates, but fewer first dates, because they're now using video chatting as a vetting process, just seeing whether they want to go out on the first date. And that's great, because on the first date, they now know they do want to kiss and hug. They've already begun to like the person. They know they want to spend some money on the date. The first dates are going to be more and more meaningful because they've gotten rid of the frogs. We're going to be kissing fewer frogs, and that's going to lead to longer courtship, later marriage, and more stability in partnerships, I think, for maybe decades to come. Actually, they are now calling the young, I love millennials. They are leading this whole process. Millennials are careful. Everybody thinks that they're reckless. I think they are a very cautious group. As a matter of fact, they're having less sex. You know, 1/3 of American millennials are living at home. Before the pandemic, they were living at home. And they weren't living at home because they were lazy. They were living at home because they want to put their career together. They want to get financially stable before they tie the knot. And they're very serious about love. They'll go out and hop into bed with somebody, but if it's not going to work, they get rid of it. You know, they've invented this term DTR, define the relationship. And I asked 5,000 singles, including an awful lot of millennials, you know, when do you have this conversation, DTR, define the relationship? And they said within 4 months. That was the average, 4 months. After 4 months of going out with somebody, you ask, where are we headed? In my day, you'd wait years. You would wait years. These people are dedicated to knowing what's going on. They want transparency. They want honesty. They want meaningful conversations. They're looking for somebody who's financially stable, and they're not going to take second best. They're going to wait. They feel they've got time, and they're using sex, I think, as an interview process. I mean, you know, these days, they know how to avoid getting pregnant. They know how to avoid disease, and they don't have to walk the walk of shame. So sex has almost become, I think, a bit of a sex.
Unbeatable prices now at USave. Pay only $134.99 Namibian dollars for Lovey's premium disposable nappies. Pay just $6.99 for 8 Nina sanitary pads. $34.99 Namibian dollars for 250 grams of Fabu Farm body cream. 1 kilo bag of Sunlight 5-in-1 washing powder costs only $29.99 Namibian dollars at USave. And both 500 milliliter New Den Pine gel and 750 milliliter Captain dishwashing liquid, just $19.99 Namibian dollars. You save. We all save at You Save.
Before the first date. And a lot of older people think that's crazy. Well, you mean you're going to have sex before the first date? Well, a lot of them forget that a first date, at least in New York City, can cost you $200. And these people want to go out and have a meaningful conversation and know that this could work. I asked the young in this Singles in America study, what's keeping you from getting serious about anybody? And millennials, say 40% of millennials said, I first want self-acceptance. Now, when do you get self-acceptance? It's very noble, but it's a noble crowd. Millennials are serious about love. There are still an awful lot of academics that hold out that there are no differences between men and women. They are fighting the last war. That war should be so over. The bottom line is that there are some real gender differences in the brain. And I'm not the only one that knows that. There's a huge amount of data that people, you know, even doing brain scanning studies on something entirely different. They're not even looking for gender differences, and they see these gender differences. And the data is just overwhelming that there are some real gender differences that evolved millions of years ago. In fact, I wrote a whole book about it called The First Sex, The Natural Talents of Women and How They're Changing the World. And indeed, as women pile into the job market in cultures around the world, they really come with some incredible assets. And of course, for millions of years, men and women did different things. Men went out hunting all the time. For that, you needed the ability to track, to surround, to throw, to hit, to drag it home. There's a lot of data from around the world in over 22 societies that men tend to be analytical, logical, direct, decisive, tough-minded, and good at what we call rule-based systems, everything from engineering to math to computers to music. Music is very spatial. It's not spatial to me. I'm not high on the testosterone scale, but, you know, I used to have a boyfriend. He knew exactly where Beethoven was changing the key, what was amusing in Beethoven. I didn't see what was amusing in Beethoven's structure, but he was able to see that. Whereas women, really are much more linguistically skilled, much better at reading posture, gesture, and tone of voice. Probably comes from millions of years of holding that baby in front of your face, cajoling it, reprimanding it, educating it with words. Women tend to be more trusting, more emotionally expressive. They tend to see the long term, men tend to see the short term. Women have a more holistic, synthetic, contextual, long-term view. They tend to be extremely imaginative. So the sexes have evolved through millions of years of doing different jobs, a host of different skills. The point is, men and women are like 2 feet. We need each other to get ahead, but we are not alike. You know, when I talk when there are not a lot of gender differences when it comes to romantic love. This is a basic brain system like the fear system or the anger system. Men and women can both get angry. Women's anger dribbles out, and whereas men explode. So there's differences, but they both feel anger in the same way. Both men and women feel the love. When we put people into the brain scanner, we found no difference in that pathway for romantic love, but they express it somewhat differently. Men fall in love faster than women do. They fall in love more often than women do. When a man meets a woman who he falls in love with, he wants to introduce her to friends and family sooner. He wants to move in sooner. We call it mate guarding. Men have more intimate conversations with their wives than women do with their husbands, because women have their intimate conversations with their girlfriends. And men are 2.5 times more likely to kill themselves when a relationship is over. So if I had to say who is the more romantic sex, I would say men rather than women. We've got a lot of data on that. Try telling that to a women's magazine. It's hopeless. I've been trying for 40 years. Yeah, I have studied romantic love and attachment for 50 years, ever since graduate school. And, but I was never really interested in marrying myself. I did marry for about 3 months when I was 23. I thought that's what you were supposed to do. I knew as I was walking down the aisle, I did not want to marry him. I only did marry him because I was so scared of my mother that I didn't dare tell her I wasn't going to do it. But she was perfectly happy with me divorcing him. She was very sweet about it when the time came. I've had 3 very long-term, very good, happy partnerships. But I got married a few months ago, and I'm 75. And you asked me why? It's not because I was scared of old age.
You see, 75 years old and she got married, like, what? Guys, there's a lover for everyone.
I'm not scared of it. I've got that somewhat under control, as much as you can. But it was the right time. I found the right guy. And I really learned something about attachment that teenagers already know. It is different. I had always maintained in these long-term romances with these other men that why marry him? You know, if I die, I'm going to give him whatever I got. I'm dedicated to the partnership. It's socially visible to the people around me. Why marry them? And so I didn't do it. And they were all perfectly happy to marry me. I've been invited many times, actually. But I just thought, this doesn't make sense to me. Why would I do that? And then last summer, I was out to dinner with a friend of mine who I'd been going out with for 5 years. And we were celebrating something, and something important. And he was drinking quite a bit of tequila, and I was drinking some red wine. And he looked at me and he said, "I'm going to marry you, Helen Fisher." And I just laughed. And then we were lying in bed, and I said to whispered to him, I said, "You know, you said to me, I'm going to marry you, Helen Fisher." And he turned to me, he said, "Oh, I must have been drunk." Well, he was joking, but I took him seriously. I said, "I'm not going to discuss that again." And the following day, we were walking through the streets in New York, and he looked at me and said, "I'm going to marry you, Helen Fisher, and this time I'm not drunk." And we got married in a field in Montana last summer, and then took a 2-week honeymoon. And instantly I saw how important this was. You know, you walk into a hotel and you say, "Well, we're on our honeymoon." Instantly people respond. It's so meaningful to people. And I remember it was about a week ago. I was going through my drawer and I saw a little note to myself. I thought I was still wondering, why did I actually get married? I mean, I was perfectly happy to get married, but how is this different? And I saw a little note that I had written to myself right after we got married and stuffed into that drawer. And I found it about a week ago. On the note, it said, "I married for adventure. He married for union." And I looked at that note and I realized I found union and he found adventure. And I've asked him many times, "How is it different?" And he says to me, "It's richer. It's deeper." And I think that's as good as I can get on it. It is richer. It is deeper. I never was going to leave him, even if I didn't marry him, but it's richer and deeper. Something that everybody else has known, and it took me 50 years to get there. But I'm there now. And you know what? I look at everybody's wedding ring. I notice every man's wedding ring, and I'm so touched. I'm more touched by a man wearing the wedding ring than a woman wearing the wedding ring. And I know something about those people. I respect them in a way that I probably didn't understand prior to this. It was very interesting, the beginning of our courtship. He worked for the New York Times for 22 years, and now he writes books. And so he had interviewed me over the years. But we were both invited 6 years ago out to a private ranch in the West. And during that course of the week, I really liked him. But I didn't push it at all. And he invited me back to the airport. It was a 2.5-hour drive. And during the course of the drive, he suddenly said, "I'm going through an absolutely terrible divorce. I'm never going out with another woman. I'm never going to get involved with another woman. Never." And I thought to myself, I'm the only one in the car. He must be telling me something. I said, "Well, okay, there's other boys around, you know." So we started for a year to go out just casually. Every 6 weeks or so, he'd invite me to go to the opera, or we'd go to the movies with a group of people, or to a museum, etc. And after a year, he'd always give me a big hug, and that was that. And then after a year of this, we were going to go down, we were going to have dinner, we were going to take a nice walk along the High Line in New York, and then we were going to go play pool. I don't know what got into me, and as we were having our cocktail, I pulled the cocktail napkin out from my drink, and I said, "Why don't we secretly write down on these two napkins what we would like to win if we win at pool?" So I wrote down a real kiss, and I put that in my pocket. I didn't know what he had written down. So we have our dinner, we take our walk, and we play pool. He creams me at pool. I had played pool, I don't know, 10 times in my life. He'd grown up with a pool table in his basement. So I open his little cocktail napkin, and it says, "Sex and clarity." So I said, "Well, okay, I got the sex part, but what do you have in mind for clarity?" And what he really wanted was friends with benefits. So I said, "Well, okay." And it was way too late now to do anything that night. So we were walking home in the dark. It was about 3 a.m. And I said to him, I said, "You know, I study romantic love. And, you know, when you start having sex with somebody, you can trigger the dopamine system in the brain and fall in love with that person. Are you willing to take that chance?" And he said, "Yes." And that's what started it. I had known, and I pointed out to him, sex is not casual. things happen in the brain. When you start having sex with somebody, any nice stimulation of the genitals drives up the dopamine system in the brain and can push you over the threshold into falling in love. And then with orgasm, there's a real flood of oxytocin and some vasopressin linked with feelings of attachment. So these three basic brain systems can often operate together. You start having sex, boom, you trigger the romantic love, you trigger the feelings of attachment, and you're off to the races. Casual sex is not casual unless you're so drunk you can't remember it. Casual sex is not casual. You can fall in love when you climb in bed together. I study millennials, and I've really come to believe that millennials are square. As a matter of fact, I was recently talking to a journalist in Russia, and they are calling their millennials the new Victorians. And that same day, I spoke to a journalist in Brazil, and she also regards millennials as the new Victorians. That term has not come to become popular in the United States yet, but millennials are square. They're having much less sex than we were in my day, in the baby boomers. In my day, herpes finally came in, but there was no really killing diseases at the time. And it was in the 60s. It was the sex and love revolution, and women were burning their bras, and women were rising up, et cetera, et cetera. And so there was a lot of sexual experimentation. The millennials today are careful. These people aren't reckless. They're going out with somebody. They want transparency. They want honesty. They want to know what's going on before they tie the knot. So they're doing this very long period of courtship before they fall in love. We do study at Match this data from around the United States. And I have a lot of data on that. I can really only talk about New York City. I study personality. And the people that gravitate to New York City express a lot of traits of the dopamine system in the brain. I call them explorers. They tend to be risk-taking, novelty-seeking, curious, creative, spontaneous, energetic, and mentally flexible. And they come to the big cities, whereas people in the suburbs tend to be more expressive of the traits in the serotonin system. I call these people builders. They tend to be conventional, traditional, cautious. They like rules and schedules and plans. They respect authority. They're more concrete and literal thinkers. And they're more likely to have a gene in the serotonin system linked with religiosity. There was one point in, Match and I held a party in New York City for singles. And as it turned out, the singles who live in New York did not want to meet singles who lived in New Jersey. And I finally realized why, in the hinterlands, in the suburbs, and in the farmlands of America, you find many more people who express the traits of the serotonin system, what I call builders, what Plato called guardians. A perfect example would be Mitt Romney or Mike Pence. Now, they live in larger metropolitan areas. But the bottom line is, I study personality, and we've evolved four very broad styles of thinking and behaving linked with the dopamine, serotonin, testosterone, and estrogen systems in the brain. And I have a great deal of data about where these people congregate. And the high dopamine, risk-taking, novelty-seeking, curious, creative, spontaneous, energetic people gravitate to the cities. And the more cautious, conventional, traditional people who respect authority and follow the rules gravitate to the hinterlands. A lot of people think that these three different brain systems, sex drive, romantic love, and feelings of attachment, are phases. They're not phases. They're brain systems. So you can start out in college or at work or wherever feeling deep attachment for somebody. You're not romantically interested in them and you don't want to have sex with them. You're feeling deeply attached to them. They've got a wife, you've got a boyfriend, etc. Then things change, they divorce, the other person divorces, you break up with your boyfriend, and boom, all of a sudden you fall in love with them. So you can start out with attachment and then fall in love with somebody and then have sex with them. Or you can fall madly in love with somebody and then have sex with them and then feel feelings of attachment. Or you can start out just having casual sex with them, boom, feelings of deep romantic love, and then move into feelings of attachment. Or you can start having sex with them and feel deep feelings of attachment, and then years later fall madly in love with them. So they're different brain systems. They're not stages. And of course, what we all really want is to sustain a long-term partnership with all three of these brain systems intact. And you can even do it in the course of a day. You wake up in the morning, you feel sexy, you make love, then you go to breakfast and suddenly he or she says something absolutely charming. You feel the rush of romantic love. And then in the middle of the day, you get a text from the person that gives you a sense of deep attachment. So all three of these brain systems can wax and wane. Sex drive certainly can wax and wane. Romantic love can certainly wax and wane. Feelings of attachment are pretty stable. It's very interesting. You can fall in love with somebody instantly. You can feel the sex drive instantly, but romantic love takes time. And in fact, we've even proven that it's hard to get rid of that feelings of attachment. You know, I mean, the main secret to getting rid of attachment is time. We've looked in the brain and found that attachment recedes often very slowly. It takes time. Whereas romantic love, that can take time too. But the bottom line is, romantic love and feelings of intense sex drive can be triggered instantly. Attachment takes time. You got to get to know the person. You got to learn to trust the person. As a matter of fact, you know, I've asked every year, I ask all these singles. I've got data on 50,000 of them now around the country, every age group, every background. What are you looking for in a partner? And the top five things are always the same. And over 95% of singles say they're looking for these five things. Somebody who respects them. Somebody who they can trust and confide in. Somebody who makes them laugh. Somebody who makes enough time for them. And somebody who they feel physically attracted to. That's different from in the past. Going back 100 years ago, a young girl living on a farm had to find a man who was from the same background, same political perspective, same social connections, and hopefully from the farm next door. We're finally at a time in human humanity when we can choose what we want for companionship. As a matter of fact, what we're doing now is we're moving forward to the kinds of partnerships that we had a million years ago. You know, for millions of years, our ancestors lived in these little hunting and gathering groups. And, you know, women commuted to gather their fruits and vegetables. They came home with over 50% of the evening meal. The double income family was the rule. Women were just as powerful as men, sexually, socially, and economically, and they could leave bad partnerships to make a better one. We settled down on the farm. Men's roles became much more important, moving the trees, moving the rocks, plowing the land, going off to local markets and coming home with the equivalent of money. Women's roles became much less important. They couldn't go off and gather. Their main job was to have babies to help them pick on the farm. And with that, we see the rise of all kinds of beliefs. A woman's place is in the home, virginity at marriage, man's the head of the household, and till death do us part. Can't leave the farm, what are you going to do? You can't cut the cow in half and take it out of town or move half of the wheat field, you're stuck. And before our eyes, right now, love is changing. We're no longer virgins at marriage. We're moving forward to the double income family. Man is no longer the head of the household. It's both the man and the woman. We are shedding the last 10,000 years of our agrarian tradition and moving forward to the kinds of partnerships that we had for millions of years, partnerships that are actually highly compatible with our ancient human spirit. After that, CEO of Match turned to me 15 years ago and asked me, why do you fall in love with one person rather than another? At that moment, I realized there has to be more to mate choice than just your childhood, just your experience. There has to be some chemical composition that drives you naturally towards him or her. And with that, that set me on the study of the biology of personality. And I was able to establish that we've evolved four very broad styles of thinking and behaving linked with the dopamine, serotonin, testosterone, and estrogen system. And I call these people the explorer, the builder, the director, and the negotiator. Now, we're all a combination of all of these traits, But we all have certain personalities. And I've never met two people who are alike. Even my identical twin sister and I are not exactly alike. But what I was able to find is that explorers, people who are very expressive of the traits in the dopamine system, they tend to be novelty-seeking, risk-taking, curious, creative, spontaneous, energetic, and mentally flexible. They're drawn to people like themselves. People who are very expressive of the traits in the serotonin system, I call them builders, they tend to be cautious, traditional, conventional. They follow the rules. They respect authority, like rules, plans, and schedules. They're concrete thinkers. They tend to be religious. They're also drawn to people like themselves. In those two cases, similarity attracts. In the other two cases, opposites attract. People who are very expressive of the traits in the testosterone system are drawn to those expressive of the traits in the estrogen system, and vice versa. For example, my boyfriend husband is very high on the dopamine system, as I am. We both have traveled all over the world a great deal. We're both writers. You got to be creative to be a writer. And we constantly do novel things together. That works. We're both high dopamine. We're built to be drawn to each other. He's very high testosterone, and I'm very high estrogen. Another natural match. But he's higher on the serotonin system than I am. He's more traditional. And it was he that invited me to marry him. He even asked me the other day, Helen, were you going to, you know, were you ever thinking of marrying me? And I said, well, no, no, not really. But he's more traditional than I am. And here I am happily married. So bottom line is no two people are alike. I've studied the, I created a questionnaire. It's now been taken by 15 million people in 40 countries. It shows where you are on all four of these scales. I then created a new business called NeuroColor, and we go into the business so that we can understand people in business as well as in love. And so, yes, when that CEO asked me, why do you fall in love with one person rather than another? It launched me on a profoundly new understanding of personality and why you fall in love with one person rather than another. And the reason that this is important is because modern psychology is, we're saturated in modern psychology. Every one of your problems is your mother's fault or your father's fault or some issue in your child. It's all your childhood. It's not all your childhood. Some people are naturally stubborn. Some people are naturally risk-taking. Some people are naturally spendthrifts. Some people are naturally dedicated to details. Some people are naturally cautious. And when you understand who your partner is in business and colleagues, clients, friends, relatives, and lovers, you can do workarounds. You don't have to spend 20 years on a couch understanding why you're a cautious person. It's who you are. And once you understand that about somebody, you can do workarounds to make a happy partnership.
Want to support the channel? Join the Big Think members community where you get access to...
Hi, my name's Johnny Thompson.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. If you have just joined us, we're doing class today. We are listening, we are listening, we are listening, we are listening, and we are learning. If you would like to call in, if you have a take, if you have a conversation, or if you have a contribution, the number in studio is 083-288-401.
I'm the staff writer at Big Think, and I'm the author of the books Mini Philosophy and Mini Big Ideas, and I run the social media account called Mini Philosophy.
Philosophy's Guide to Happiness with Johnny Thompson. Why has the study of happiness become your focus?
So I started the Mini Philosophy project about 7 years ago, and the aim was to try to teach philosophy to everybody. And so the idea was to duck and weave my way through the different philosophical traditions and different philosophical schools throughout time. And what you notice is that over time, certain themes start to emerge. So if you imagine the history of philosophy as a kind of heat map, what you notice is that there are certain bubbles and certain hotspots start to pop up. And for me, I noticed that there were three particular ones which started to emerge. And they're all to do with happiness. They're all to do with how to live the best life and how to be a good person. And so I wanted to dig into those a lot more, because obviously if you focus on the details of philosophy, you'll notice there's massive differences. Like comparing Confucius and Kant to Al-Ghazali, it's very difficult to do. But if you zoom out, And if you look at philosophy like this heat map, you do start to notice certain commonalities and certain themes starting to emerge. And that's what interested me, and that's what is about happiness. The current project and work at the moment is to focus on happiness because it's an incredibly important thing to get right. So Aristotle in his Nicomachean Ethics argued that everything we do in life is for some purpose. So I go to school to get an education, I get an education to get a job, and I get a job so that I get money to buy nice things and so on and so on. But the question Aristotle asks is, what is the end point of all this? What lies at the top of the ladder? And for Aristotle, that is happiness. The point of all human life is to reach happiness. And in the centuries or so after Aristotle, these different schools emerged, which were each trying to sell their version of happiness. You have Epicureanism, you have skepticism, you have cynicism, and you have stoicism, all of which are trying to sell happiness and their way as the true route to happiness. And that interested me. Because if you step outside Greece, you see a very similar story emerging. And it's not just in Athens. It's in China, and it's in the Middle East, and it's in the European tradition as well. So that interests me, and I want to dig in what commonalities we can find between all of the greatest minds in the history of philosophy.
Why is happiness elusive?
I think it's so elusive because the term itself is so laden, and there's a lot of different ways of understanding the term happiness. So my 4-year-old son at the moment, for example, is learning how to read emotions in kindergarten, and they teach them how to recognize sadness and anger and happiness. And of course, the happy photo is someone with a beaming smile. And of course, that's what you do for a 4-year-old child. You teach them to read the basics of emotions. But the problem is, when we grow up, we don't really lose that image of happiness. We associate happiness as being this beaming smile with a selfie on social media. But I think happiness is not a smiling face. It's more a smiling soul. And I think we don't really like religious terms as much these days. But I think that expression, smiling soul, is probably the closest we can come to understanding what happiness really is. And in fact, Aristotle, when he uses the word eudaimonia, that translates literally as good spirit. So I think the idea of a laughing or a smiling soul is really important to happiness. But why do we find it confusing? Why is it hard to understand? I think Taoism offers a really good analogy here. So Taoism is about the Tao, which is the way, which is this kind of mystical, kind of fundamental force which underpins everything. And an analogy that some Taoists use is that imagine life as like a dense, thorny forest. And in the middle of this forest is a well-paved superhighway. And it's easy to walk along that path. It's even fun to walk along that path. But there are other paths. But these paths go through swamps, they go through thorns, they go up and down hills, and they are difficult. And I think happiness is a little bit like that. There's certain paths, there's certain ways to happiness which feel right and are right. But there are so many different paths with their different sirens calls which attract us. And I think we don't realize we're on the wrong path, often until it's too late, and we find the going really difficult. So if we imagine happiness as being on the right path, if we follow the Taoist metaphor, then the question we've got to ask ourselves is, if we are unhappy, what's going on there? And the question then is about finding the right path again. If we return back to this kind of heat map analogy, there are certain lights which emerge in the history of philosophy and theology as well, which are meant to act as beacons or guides with which we can walk towards. So if we are unhappy, then we should work towards these lights. And I've identified 3 lights, or what I like to call pillars of happiness. And if we are unhappy, we should walk back towards these.
What are the 3 pillars of happiness?
So if we're trying to find our way back to the path and we're trying to follow these lights, we have to know what those lights are. And the first pillar, or light number 1, is the idea that happiness is not measured by pleasure. So the ancient Greeks had a lot of different words for happiness, and one of them is hedonia. And hedonia is what we might want to call simple pleasure. It's eating a Michelin-starred steak, but it's also binging on the KFC bucket. It's a big night out with some friends, but it's also drinking a herbal tea on the sofa. It's quite easy to measure, and it's quite easy to understand because it's an emotional affect. It's pleasure. This idea is essential to Buddhism. So Buddhists tend to define pleasure as being a desire satisfied. So I want a drink of water, and so I reach for the water, and I drink it, and that gives me a pleasure. But the problem, of course, is that this is an unwinnable game. Every day we have millions and millions of desires, and it's like a game of impossible whack-a-mole, and there's no possible way we can satisfy them all. Even if we had all of the time in the world and all of the money of Elon Musk, there's no way we can satisfy all of our desires. So if we're to make sense of that word happiness, if we're to be happy at all, it has to be found outside of this notion of pleasure. And what's interesting is about 2,000 years ago, in a very different tradition in Protestant Denmark, Soren Kierkegaard was making the same point. Kierkegaard wrote a book called The Seducer's Diary, which is found in his work Either Or. And in there, we meet a character called Johannes, who is this aesthete who's living the life for Riley. They're like a first-year university student going out drinking and womanizing and having the time of their life. But the problem is, as we read the book, we realize that his life is pretty shallow and Johannes gets bored. When I teach Kierkegaard, I tend to describe him as similar to a vampire in one of those vampire movies. There's a common trope where the vampire who's been living for hundreds of years is just bored of existence. They've drunk all of the drinks they can drink. They've done all the drugs they can do. They've slept with all of the people they can possibly sleep with. And they're lying on their sofa in this kind of listless state of dissatisfaction, and they're just bored of life. And so they often turn to increasingly brutal and disturbing things to keep the entertainment going. But the idea is that if we want to have more in life, if we want to be truly happy, we have to step beyond pleasure. We have to step beyond hedonia. Eudaimonia, though, is a much harder word to understand, and this is what Aristotle means when he talks about happiness. Eudaimonia is often translated as flourishing, and the reason why it's difficult to understand is that it's often understood in reverse. So there are many moments in life where we look back on our experiences and think they were really hard at the time, but actually we were supremely happy. For example, raising young kids or even school can be quite hard at the time, but we look back and think those were moments of flourishing, and those were moments where I was deeply, supremely happy. And that's what Aristotle talks about when he talks about eudaimonia. But of course, most people are pretty familiar with that idea now. The idea that pleasure isn't happiness is an old idea. But the problem is that we risk going too far. It's a logical fallacy to say that just because pleasure doesn't equal happiness, that suffering therefore must. And it's a risk that we fetishize suffering, that we enjoy this kind of masochistic misery, and we see that as essential to flourishing. But of course, that's not true. And the second pillar, the second light which emerges across all these traditions is moderation, that we have to find a middle way. And moderation is essential to a lot of philosophies. It's found in the Buddhist's middle way, and it's in Aristotle's golden mean. So Aristotle, for example, argued that if we want to be virtuous in life, if we want to find the virtue, it lies between two vices. There's the vice of excess and the vice of deficiency. So let's say the virtue of courage. It's found between the vice of excess, which is recklessness, and the vice of deficiency, which would be cowardice. So the middle way is how we're to be virtuous. And as we see later on in his Nicomachean Ethics, to be virtuous is also to be happy. And so we need some kind of moderation. So happiness is not pleasure, and happiness is not suffering. And that idea of moderation pops up again and again and again. It's essential to Taoism. And most people are familiar with the yin-yang symbol, which features a black dot on a white background and a white dot on a black background. And the idea is that life is not black or white, but rather it's a confused and confusing cocktail of things. It's a soup. There is no white, there is no black, everything is gray. So yin tends to represent the dark, the mysterious, the elusive, water, fluidity. And yang tends to represent the exciting, the passionate, the loud, the sunny, and truth. And so for Taoists, we have to find the middle path, which is walking between yin and yang. More recently, I've read a book by a mythologist called Martin Shaw called Courting the Wild Twin. And rather than yin and yang, he tends to use the word castle and forest life. So Shaw talks about this myth where when we're all born, we are born with a wild twin. And because of the society we live in and because of the world that we live in, this wild twin is thrown out to the forest. And we live our life in the castle. We live our life in a safe, anodyne environment. But every now and again, we'll hear a call. We'll hear this whisper of the wild. And it's unignorable. It's always there. And this is our wild twin who needs our attention and wants our attention. So where Taoists talk about yin and yang and Shaw talks about this forest life and the castle life, I think moderation is one of the most essential pillars to happiness. So we've seen so far that we have two pillars. The first pillar is that pleasure does not mean happiness, and that happiness is much fuller and deeper than that. And the second pillar is that we have to have some degree of moderation if we're to be happy. But the third thing that I noticed appearing again and again across all these various philosophies and religions is the idea that happiness is an unavoidable emergent state of goodness, that you cannot be truly and meaningfully happy unless you are also virtuous. But of course, this raises a problem. And the problem is, what does virtuous mean? Because if we zoom in on any different culture and any different time, what people define as right and wrong and good and bad will change from person to person, from philosopher to philosopher. But if we zoom out, if we look at the broader picture, we can see certain trends emerging across different times. And this is the idea that certain virtues are always virtues for different cultures across different times. And certain vices have always been seen as certain vices. So this is an argument made, for example, by the philosopher James Rachels and more recently by Paul Stearns. But the idea is that we can recognize about five virtues and vices which have always been so throughout time. The first is altruism and the vice egoism. So this is seen in Augustine's Code for Monks and it's seen in Islam Zakat. It's there in Peter Singer and Immanuel Kant and Thomas Aquinas. And the idea is a sense of other-regardedness, charity and caring for other people. So the second is kindness and cruelty. So this is best represented by the golden mean, which most people are familiar with this from the Gospels, which is do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. But it's not just in the Gospels. It's seen in Sanskrit, in Tamil, in Persian, in ancient Greece, and in the Vedas. But it's also seen in modern times in Kant's first categorical imperative and in Aquinas' natural law. Be good and kind to other people. And the third virtue vice is justice and injustice. I think if you put Plato and Mencius and John Rawls in the same room, they would agree about the need for justice, which is the idea of some kind of retribution for wrongdoers. The fourth virtue vice is wisdom and ignorance. Socrates famously wrote that the unexamined life is not worth living, and the Buddha encourages disciples to meditate at great length on the universe. I can't think of any major philosopher who's been treated seriously for long who advocates for ignorance. And the fifth virtue vice is humility and arrogance. And I think this has two strands, really. The first is a kind of intellectual humility, which is represented best by John Stuart Mill. And the second is a kind of existential humility, which is represented by the religions. It's in Karl Barth, it's in Maimonides, and the word Islam literally translates as surrender to Allah. This is the idea that you are not the center of the universe. There are things outside of your understanding which are far more powerful and which we occasionally have to bow to.
How can we apply the three pillars of happiness to our lives?
So, of course, the problem is when you zoom out and look at all these philosophies, it can come across as very abstract. So we can look at a few examples about how these kind of pillars or these lights might relate to everyone's everyday life. So if we're looking at pillar number one, which is the idea that happiness cannot be measured by pleasure, I think a really good example of this is parenting. If you ever go on social media and you see a reel or a post about a new parent, it's inevitably moaning about something, their sleep-deprived nights or the germs or their kids aren't eating anything, and it's full of stress and what appears to be misery. But then if you commented on those posts saying, well, why did you bother having kids in the first place? Or why do kids make you unhappy? Often parents will reply, I'm the happiest I've ever been. And I think parenting is an example of looking back at a stage of your life and thinking all of the ingredients might have been pretty hard in themselves. But as a whole, I was deeply existentially happy. So pillar number two is the idea of moderation in all things. And I think this is best seen in dieting. So most diets end within a month or if not weeks, and most New Year's resolutions end pretty quickly. And it's because they're often very extreme. It's I'm going to go to the gym every day and run half marathons, or I'm going to give up chocolate, or I'm never going to drink alcohol ever again. And they fail because they are so extreme. And the best diets in history, for example, Weight Watchers, allow a degree of flexibility. There's a degree of moderation. They allow for cheat days and the occasional snack or the occasional drink. So dieting, when it's done at these extremes, does work for some people, no doubt. But for most people, dieting is best when it exists in this middle way. And pillar number three is the idea that you can't be happy unless you are also good to some degree, which might seem ridiculous to lots of people because we can point to people who seem to be pretty cruel or immoral, and yet they seem to be also very happy. But in 2012, the evolutionary psychologist Robin Dunbar did an interesting study into gossip. And he argued that gossip is a kind of social culling where we talk to people about the immoral, the cruel people in our lives, the cheaters and the thieves, so we can shun them. But inversely, people who are friendly and good will also attract friends. And so the argument is that if you are cruel, you do not have friends. And if you do not have friends, you cannot be happy. Inversely, those who are kind will attract friends and they'll also be happy for it. So what I find really interesting is if you zoom out and look at the history of philosophy, you see these three pillars emerging. And they act essentially as a diagnostic tool. If you feel you are unhappy in life, you can look at these pillars and think, which of these three am I not meeting? Is it that I'm confusing a hard patch of my life with being unhappy? Is it that I'm going to two extremes? Or is it that possibly I'm not being as good as I could be? If we recognize that those are the problems in our life, we can take steps to fix it.
What is true love?
So I'm a pretty soppy person anyway, and it doesn't take much to make me cry. But I can guarantee you one thing which will always make me cry is if I look at pictures of old couples in love. If you see a husband and wife who have been married for many years sitting on the bench and holding hands, or an elderly couple walking along the beach, it's guaranteed to make me cry. And I think it's a common thing. I think there's something quite magical when you look at a love which has lasted that long, through all of the wrinkles and the rheumatism and the grey hairs, that there's that kind of love, that kind of core to those two people. And I think the reason why that echoes with a lot of people is that it ties into what Plato thought about love. Because for Plato, love is something which goes beyond appearances. It goes beyond the changeable world. Plato described two types of love. The first love is vulgar love, which is the love of the material world. It's the love of things. It's born of pleasure. And when we talk about romantic relations, we might want to associate it more with attraction or eroticism. But Plato says that this is an inferior love to what he calls the pure or the true love, and that's one which sees behind the appearances. It sees behind the facade. It sees behind the beauty. So the thing is, most relationships will start in some form of vulgar love. There's a kind of attraction to that person, be that a friend or a romantic partner. But what Plato's advice is that we have to push past that, and we have to try to seek the soul behind the body. We have to see the mind behind the eyes. And to do that, we have to be with them, and we have to ask important questions, and we have to both want the same thing. So the word platonic love these days is often associated with a kind of friendship love. So I love you in a kind of platonic way means that you're my friend and that there's no sexual relations here at all. And when Plato is talking about love, he isn't necessarily talking about love as being divorced from sex. You can have sex in a platonic relationship. But Plato would argue that sex in and of itself is not what true love is. Sex can reach a point where you are in union with that person, where you see behind their appearances and you see behind the flesh and you experience something which is more transcendental. It's mystical. And so Plato would argue that love is not blind, but the opposite, in fact. Love is piercingly insightful. Love sees behind the cracked smiles and the wrinkles and the fake laughs, and it sees the person there. And I think that's why we find people who have survived all the changes of life very beautiful and moving and meaningful.
Is there right and wrong?
Discussing right and wrong can often be very difficult. In fact, Christmases have probably been ruined over that very thing. Wars have been fought over right and wrong. But at the turn of the 18th century, the philosopher Jeremy Bentham gave us a surprisingly simple calculation about how we can work out what is right and wrong. Jeremy Bentham became the father of the theory known as utilitarianism, which is the idea that a good action is one which creates the greatest good for the greatest number. So Bentham argued that if we're to decide if an action is right or wrong, we have to set it against seven different criteria of pleasure. The first is intensity, so how intense is the pleasure? The second is duration, so how long does it last? The third is proximity, so how close is it to you or how far away is it? The fourth is fecundity, does this pleasure produce more pleasure? The fifth is purity, does this pleasure also create pain? The sixth is extent, how widespread is the pleasure? And the seventh is likelihood, so how likely is that pleasure to happen or not? So what we do is once we've calculated our pleasure, we add all the numbers together and we decide whether this action right now creates more pleasure or more pain. And we do the action which creates more pleasure. Of course, there's a whole host of problems with this, not least who defines pleasure. And it's a problem that John Stuart Mill, who's Bentham's successor, tried to resolve. But one of the biggest problems is who actually has time for this. In any given day, we have thousands of ethical decisions and no one can sit down and draw out an hedonic calculus.
How does someone become evil?
There are many different theories of evil in the history of philosophy. So Thomas Aquinas, for example, argued that it's when we stray from the natural law. And many people might argue that evil is something innate and that we are born evil. But Hannah Arendt has a very different theory, and hers is all to do with banality. In 1961, Adolf Eichmann found himself in court. Eichmann was one of the orchestrators of the Holocaust. And in the court was the philosopher Hannah Arendt looking in. And what she noticed was something peculiar. But this was not a Disney villain. This was not somebody who looked monstrous. This was a boring bureaucrat. And she asked herself, how is it that a whole nation of people, just like Eichmann, could turn themselves to do something so horrendous as the Holocaust? A lot of Arendt's work is discussing what are the ingredients necessary for a society to turn towards totalitarianism. And she comes up with two answers. The first answer is that a society has to feel disconnected and fragmented. People don't form any communities, and any sense of community has to be decided by the powers that be. The second factor is that all of the problems and fears of your society are because of some external force. It might be Jews, but it might be communists, it might be any foreigners, it's some shadowy other who's causing you to feel this way. From there, Hannah Arendt asked the question, how is it that someone like Eichmann could become part of the Holocaust? And in her book, The Human Condition, Hannah Arendt believes that a human needs three things to flourish and to thrive. She says we need action, labor, and work. Labor is what we might call the everyday drudgery of just getting by. It's washing yourself in the shower, it's cleaning dishes, it's getting the kids to school, it's just ending the day as you started. The second is work, and this is where we feel we're giving back to society. It might be that we're producing something in a factory, or we're providing a service to someone as a banker or an accountant. But the third, and arguably most important, is action, and this is where we feel as though we're part of the political forum. We feel as though that we have a voice, and our voice is heard, that we can discuss with other people our political opinions, and they can discuss theirs with us. What Hannah Arendt argued is that totalitarianism and Nazi Germany denies people action. It denies them a sense of meaning and a sense of joining something bigger and being part of the discussion. So when Hannah Arendt watched Adolf Eichmann in court, she wasn't watching a fully realized human being. She was watching a drone. He never questioned himself because he was denied access to himself. He only had targets to meet and promotions to get, and he was only following orders because orders were all he had.
Why does money matter in our society?
The best inventions are those which become so important to our lives, we can't even imagine a world without them. There was a time, for example, when people lived without money. Let's imagine that tomorrow all of the money in the world were to disappear. No more banks, no more notes, and no more numbers on screens. How would you get by? How would you do anything? Would you exchange your services for a product? Would you say, I will give you a haircut in return for a steak? It's only when we imagine the world without something that we appreciate how important that thing is. And money is probably one of the most useful and important tools humans have ever invented. Money goes back a very long way, but it began in Egypt and around the Fertile Crescent and in the Middle East. Back then, money was more like a chit which you would exchange for a bag of grain at your local granary. So the chit would say, the bearer of this chit is entitled to 3 bags of grain. And that this bearer is entitled to bit is really important, because if the chit was attached to me, Johnny Thompson, it couldn't be used as a method of exchange. But the problem is that money is only as good as the authority which underwrites it. So if you took your chit to a granary and they said, we're not going to give you any grain, you would no longer use that chit. Most of us today are lucky to live in governments where the money that we have is worth something. But if you live in Zimbabwe or North Korea, you'll know what it's like to have all of your life savings vanish overnight because your currency suddenly means nothing. It was the Chinese who first got wise to the idea that carrying coins around in your bags is not only impractical, but also very expensive. And so they were the first to invent not only paper, but paper money. And under the Song Dynasty, that was then universalized for the whole country. Today, it's hard to imagine a world without money. It's hard to imagine a time where we'd have to exchange 3 chickens for 1 sheep. Money is probably one of the most important inventions in all humankind, and we don't even think about it.
Why is philosophy relevant to all of us?
I think a lot of people see philosophy as being this kind of esoteric ivory tower pursuit by people wearing cardigans and discussing the most ridiculous of things. And to be fair, my first experiences of university weren't too far away from that. Whenever I talk about this, I remember a lecturer who walked in, and he spent half an hour of the lecture taking his glasses off and putting them back on. And he kept saying, "Isn't it amazing how the world depends upon two tiny lenses?" And I tell people that that was what I paid for at university. And in that same year, I remember writing an essay in Formal Logic with the title, "What Is Is?" I had to write 2,500 words on the law of identity. I would also say that's not a bad thing. I would say that some people enjoy doing philosophy in the same way that they enjoy doing a Sudoku. But the point I wanted to make was that philosophy is not always like this. In fact, I would argue that philosophy is at its best when it's not like this. So ethics, for example, underpins our laws and our political institutions, and the philosophy of religion is about the most important questions we can ask of ourselves. But I think the biggest way in which philosophy infuses our everyday and is incredibly useful is through self-help. And I think if you look at a lot of modern self-help books, what they've done is they have diluted philosophy and they've made it accessible and applicable to modern life. And that's fine. But what I would argue is if you go back to those original philosophical texts, you'll actually find a depth there that you lack in a lot of modern self-help books. So one of the greatest examples of this, I think, is in cognitive behavioral therapy. I distinctly remember in the early 1990s when I just come back from school in a grump. I don't know what it was about. I probably got a bad grade or I fell out with some friends. And my mum, who was a therapist, she said to me, "Choose your mood." And if you really want to irritate a teenager, what you should say to them is choose your mood. And only in hindsight do I realize that she'd probably just come back from a CBT refresher course. Because cognitive behavioral therapy is a hugely effective talking therapy, which was popularized by Aaron Beck and Albert Ellis in the 1960s. And what's interesting is if you put CBT next to Stoicism, you can find a huge amount of similarities. The first is acceptance. So in Stoicism, there's this idea that you have to accept that there are certain things in life which are beyond your control. So the Buddha, for example, talks about the remembrances of old age and sickness and death. And these are things we cannot fix. They're things we cannot control. And the Stoics said the same thing. We have to recognize that there's a great many things in our life which we just cannot control. For example, other people's opinions. What people think of you is beyond your power. So you just have to accept them. And the second commonality is to do with rationality. And this is the idea that we can, to some degree, know ourselves. We can look in on our inner lives and recognize our emotions and our motivations. We can distance ourselves from our emotions and our feelings to look at them. And that distance is really important to Stoicism and CBT both. And the third commonality between the two is what's called the gap or the space or the pause. And this is an idea popularized by Epictetus, but it forms the bedrock of CBT. And this is the idea that between the world and our reaction, there is a pause. And into that pause, we can choose how we are to react. Nothing in life is predetermined, and we can decide how we will respond to the world. So my mum might have been right. I can choose my mood. But there is a risk of overworking the connection, because CBT is a proven talking therapy, which has been proven through experiment after experiment, and I'm sure many people have their own anecdotal experiences with it. Stoicism is an entire philosophy. For example, they believed in the logos, which is this rational force underpinning the universe, and they also believed that we have to be virtuous and moral. If you're looking at any therapies, whether we're looking at CBT, RBT, or psychoanalysis, what you see is a common thread, which is that we are talking. And that's what I think philosophy does best. Because I think when you're doing philosophy, you are talking about these issues in a way which is really healthy. You're objectifying them. You're treating them on the table to be examined. You dig up your problems and you dissect them as a group intellectually. I think any therapist who's worth their weight will look at you unjudgmentally. And I think what philosophy does is look at our own problems in a similar intellectual, unjudgmental way. So I remember when I was a teacher at school, a lot of students would come up to me afterwards and say, "Sir, I found that really useful. I found that really important to understanding my own issues." Because when you're reading philosophy and you're looking at these philosophers' lives, while you're reading about their intellectual journeys at their times, you're also reading about yourself. So Montaigne, for example, is this 16th century diarist, and he's also a philosopher, and he's talking about a whole range of things. He talks about friendship, he talks about love, he talks about relationships. And it's tempting to think that when you're reading Montaigne, you're actually reading about this 16th century Frenchman, but you're not. You're really reading about yourself. And I think it's really important for philosophy to unpack those. I think it's also really important that we bring interesting conversations back into society. Life is too full of these boring and shallow conversations. I think what it does is two things. The first is that it distances ourselves from other people. You can't get to know anyone else unless you have these deep and important conversations. And the second problem is that you're distanced from yourself. You don't get to understand what really matters to you and what motivates you. At the risk of overplaying my hand, I think this could transform society. Because I believe that a lot of people today feel very disconnected from each other and from their cultures. And the sociologist Emile Durkheim talked about this word anomie, which is a disconnection from our culture and our people. And I think if we go about our lives ignoring these conversations and refusing to see people and talk about these deep, meaningful things, we start to disassociate from each other and we fracture and we fragment. And I think if we have to come back together, we have to have these important conversations. We have to go past talking about the weather and we have to ask about God and about our worries and about our existential angst. And we have to talk about right and wrong. And it's only through that conversation that we can come together to understand each other and to form a community and to be understood and to understand other people as well.
Want to support the channel? Join the Big Think members community where you get access to...
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, eh? And I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
Lipurane ngelo wapumbwa Eva tere ulikoni maundu tuto ingida ashike kapeno nwe kutite opoye ekukulile. Oshafa fana nongeshefa ili mehola mo ihewe tike kovano ile koshuala. Onongeshefa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano. Okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi toda njuka. Okukwetira oipindi konu konda doili nawa. Nune udo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshefa omarudi dayo loka. Opone ushendife nawa nukumona oijamo ili nawa. Ninge pata fano na Monica ko Eagle FM. Onora itatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali. Ile kongerewa nora itatu natu bali o itatu matatu o mafelane Eagle FM.
Want to know about Namibia's latest business and economic news? Then look no further than the Villager newspaper. The Villager is an e-paper that is published every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for free, directly to your phone or computer. To become a subscriber, simply send a WhatsApp message with your number and email address to 081-200-4144. Be sure to save the phone number as a contact. The Villager, wherever you are.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
So not a fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in parliament, let me not take up my Katatura menace.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura. Uh-huh. And I...
Ritava zende kize, imba izwezipiri. Luekerize mikwaye nguyencha kukona kunolofaza kwa nkufisa, hamo cholo ni mata amskavu anakale. Kara mitukiserize kuvona msevelezo wa imba ye, mufumane lisevelezo zezwezipiri ze kakulifafela mashiling alika na $36 million kakweli. Kapa kamikwaye kutesifa fasi ye tatama, 5% machipisa hamungolisari kwerize talu, 10% machipisa hamungolisari kwerize sirela, 25% machipisa hamungolisari kwerize lishumiperi. Muketeri kwerize zo movata kulimukone kukala kuikola zende zeo imba inisualezi fama chipisa. Imba, toku kukandiri fasi kaufela. Mwipe kwa lisevelezo za imba kachenu kulimukone kuikola zende kaufela.
Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to do.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
If you grew up without enough love, you get very, very good at imagining love where there is no love. And so limerence, I think it could happen to all kinds of people, but mostly it happens to traumatized people.
Mm-hmm.
And especially for whatever reason, well, I have a guess at why, this is just a guess, but children of alcoholics seem especially prone to limerence, I've noticed, because I just get hundreds of letters and people tell me their background mm-hmm. and what's going on. Because there are some parents who are so abusive, they never pay attention or love you. But like an alcoholic parent, sometimes they love you so much. They're like, you're my best friend, little buddy. You know? Mm. and then the next day they don't care about you at all.
Yeah.
And so there's this, it's like a trauma bond with a ghost and you're set up to just be very attached where there's no love coming back.
Yeah.
And the addictive substance there is hope that they will come back.
Mm.
Maybe if you can say the right thing or be nice enough or pretty enough or, you know, fawning enough or whatever, they will realize that you're the one. So it's an addiction level obsession, romantic obsession with somebody else who you can't have. They're not open to that, or occasionally they would do it, but they're married or something like that. But in any case, you can't have them. But your whole life becomes built around this fantasy of, but what if you could? And what if you could say the right thing? And what are they thinking right now? And are they thinking about me? And it can go really far. And there's a whole industry of people who prey on such people to tell them what they want to hear. And that includes some psychics and tarot card readers and the whole twin flame idea to give people hope where there really isn't hope. And even if there was hope, why would you want to pursue a relationship with somebody who won't be with you?
Mm-hmm.
That's like so funny. Somebody had to tell me this. The number one quality, like the best quality in a man, Anna, that you really must look for. And I was like eager, like, yes, what's that number one quality? They can be with you and will be with you. I'm like, it's like that one.
That's
number one. That's like, without that, nothing else matters. Without that, nothing else matters.
Yeah. You mentioned trauma bond. What is a trauma bond and how can you break it?
A lot of people talk about it's used casually to mean relationship between traumatized people, but it has a specific meaning actually. And it's a strange phenomenon. You can do it even with animals, if you're cruel to them, where you switch on approval and kindness and love, and then you switch it off. And then you switch it on, you switch it off. You know who's perfected this is like kidnappers and people who take hostages and political prisoners, where you're alternately hot and cold and hot and cold. And even animals will form an oversized attachment to such a person.
Mm.
And it's a malfunction of our nervous system. It's probably, I suppose it has some evolutionary function, but it's nothing but trouble. When it's going hot, cold, it will make it feel like you have to hold on tighter.
Yeah.
And boy, you take a traumatized person and you put them with somebody who blows hot and cold. Well, nobody else would be with, you know, if somebody had secure attachment and was raised by loving parents, when somebody goes cold on them, they're like, oh, I see, you're not a suitable partner, and they're out of there.
Yeah.
So I guess only a traumatized person would stay to keep experiencing this, but the attachment can feel so strong, it feels life and death.
Yeah.
So I think that's a lot what it's like to have a parent who is alcoholic, and it wouldn't be strictly that. I can certainly imagine many scenarios where parents would be super lovey-dovey and then cold the next day. Or completely out of it, or they meet some new guy. You know, like say your parent is a love addict or something, and they're like, I'm going to be the best dad ever, and they're really great for 2 weeks, and it was the best 2 weeks of your life, and then they meet some new person, and they forget all about you, and so that's the form of trauma that a lot of people have experienced, and it didn't even used to be understood as trauma. Did they hit you? No. Did they? you know, they just totally emotionally took off and, or physically. Mm-hmm. And so that primes you to feel a romantic attraction. And I call it the eroticization of abandonment. I made up a word for it, but where you don't really feel about somebody unless they reject you a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that just like so sad?
It's sad, but so many people go through that. And that intermittent reinforcement you mentioned, that's the... so addictive.
Yes.
Yeah, especially for someone who is anxiously attached.
Yes. Mm. It's so addictive. But it gets to the point where somebody who just goes, look, I'm a good person. I really like you. I'm not going anywhere. When you've been deep in the problem kind of relationship for a long time, those people are not attractive. You're like, ew, normal.
Don't feel chemistry.
I feel no chemistry. Mm-hmm. That can change though. But it takes a period of healing before your proper attraction can resurface and make itself known to you.
Yeah.
To be attracted to things that are good for you, which is what attraction is meant for.
Mm.
It is good for you.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Yeah. What the term you mentioned, what was it?
Eroticization.
Okay.
It's actually sexy.
Mm.
You know, like I might lose you, or I did, or breakup sex as an example.
Mm.
You know, it's going to be over, but wow, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so the eroticization of abandonment.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't make this up, but a lot of our sexuality and attraction is formed by those early relationships and what the dynamic was with our mm-hmm. caregivers. And so...
Can you delve deeper into that? I feel like nobody talks about it.
Yeah.
Such an interesting topic.
Yeah. Well... These are my personal opinions. You know, I'm not a therapist, but I'm just an observer of life. And I sat in a lot of 12-step meetings and watched people with their suffering and their journey of like, what did they do about it? And did they ever change? And, I think, you know, Freud introduced us to the idea that our sexuality is formed, you know, by our relationship, say, with your mother, but it could be with both parents, right?
Yeah.
And it's before consciousness, before language, that it's not something you're in strict control of. I don't think anybody can really help who they feel attracted to, or they can't help who they fall in love with. And it can feel like a curse that will never change. And so some people have a very pathological form of attraction. I don't even want to go there, but like children, right?
Yeah.
So it cannot be acted on. It simply cannot be acted on. And then some of us have these gray area things where you're free to go ahead to get together with an abusive person or a person who doesn't like you. It's not a crime, but you will never be happy. And you could be hurting other people, let's say, if you're going for married people. So it's a pretty serious thing. And it's very hard to change by trying to change directly, like who you go for. And this is the great delusion. It'll all be better, you know, if I just meet the right guy, this will all go away. And I think there are such cases where somebody met somebody who just loved them so much the right way that it just sort of sorted the whole thing out. But more often, I think people who are not able to change this within will get worse and worse over time and eventually become isolators.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're late in life and you're sick, you end up, you don't have the kind of relationships where people are there caring for you, visiting you, inviting you for holidays. It's a tragic outcome. And so changing within means first you stop taking the poison. And until you're sober from the poison, you're not going to be able to see the path forward. That's certainly my experience, and it's what I coach people and teach in my courses. First, you stop taking the poison. And that can be hard. And usually none of us will take such a bold move to say, I'm going to cut off all these kind of half measured relationships with people who I kind of like, but they don't like me, or vice versa. I used to keep around when I was single, these men who I knew they were kind of into me and hoping I would come around. And I would tell them, I'm not into you. It's never going to happen. I go, there, I did my duty.
Mm-hmm.
Now I can just use them as company. But I don't believe that anymore. That hurts them. That's like vampire behavior. You're just taking from them.
Mm-hmm.
Can I have your love me energy, even though I'm never going to give it back? Even though you consent, the way that somebody goes, oh, fine, vampire, take all my blood. That's not really what they mean. And as people who are trying to become better people, we have to take responsibility to not steal from people like that, not use them, and to trust that we can care for ourselves without them, and to treat them honorably on their, as we end the relationship. So that's one of the things I did, is I called up all those like strange relationships I had, and I said, you've been a great friend. You've done nothing wrong. I'm trying to change my life right now, and I just realized there's this, you know, attraction thing. You have it or I have it. And I think it's just kind of keeping me trapped. And so with all respect, I need to like end our friendship. Thank you. And they all would be like, what, you know, what are you doing? And I did it as kindly as I could. I did nothing wrong by ending those relationships, but it was the best advice somebody ever gave me, was just stop doing that. It was so quickly that a light began to shine that made me attractive to available, appropriate people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So many people do that. They'll keep around someone, you know, that likes them. And maybe they told them, like, oh, I don't like you. And they still stick around hoping.
We can be friends.
But they'll keep them around just, you know, for the validation and everything. And they're like,
It's the culture, you know, it's sort of like, well, we're going to end our romantic relationship of 2 years, but we can still be friends. And if you've got a little bit of trauma and abandonment going on, you'll be like, okay. And next thing you know, you're going with your ex and their new partner to the movies, and you're just sitting there like dying and trying to act like, no, I'm fine. This is all right. Next time you guys.
And, I just find, you know, what you mentioned about sexuality very interesting and fascinating as well. And I think a lot of people, they can be sexually attracted to someone unless they're either, there's some emotional unavailability, there's some detachment. And then when they are in a loving relationship, and maybe they're emotionally connected to the partner and they love them, but there's no sexual attraction.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
Yeah, no, it's, you know, so I've been married a long time now. So now I've had a chance to sort of live a lot of different like realities of this. And what I've been learning about like long-term love is, everybody knows that, like that big sparky thing passes. But the long-term love was something I'd never experienced before. I had had sort of like companion, you know, I don't know, they lasted long enough that we were truly friends, but something went wrong. That happened a couple of times. But now I'm in a, like, I'm committed for life to my husband. And there are days when I don't like him, you know, I'm mad at him about something. And I never really felt married until I had a chance for that kind of love to start like manifesting in my heart, of that. I just never had that. I think my love, the way that I used to fall for people was sort of utilitarian in a weird way. And I wouldn't have described it that way then. I was so passionate. But when the other person is inconvenient for you, they need something that wrecks your day. My husband had to be in the hospital overnight right before I had to take a big trip in May. He was fine, as it turned out. But I was prepared to like cancel my trip, not because they knew, you know, he didn't need me medically there or anything, but I wanted him to be okay. And I was prepared to do that. And he ended up saying, it's really okay. And I was like, but is it really okay? And that's how the first time I experienced that love was with my kids, where I would have like put my own life before theirs. I would have jumped on the railroad tracks to get them off the track if I had to. And to have that kind of love like opens you up. And that's the kind of love that's committed love, where it's not that you don't jump on railroad tracks every day, but you really, really want the best for them, and you care about them, and that love is this bigger, wider thing. And so like that's connection. And what's been interesting to me is, like, our first years of marriage, I wouldn't say were very healing. It was scary and stressful for me all the time. I was terrified all the time. I'm going to blow it. I'm going to, you know, or you don't like me anymore. And I wasn't terrified all the time, but I was insecure. And now I've had a chance to settle down. And it's just the most incredible healing thing in the world. Like, all that abandonment and neglect I went through as a kid, like, I'm with somebody. I'll tell you that this is very personal, but I'm going to say it here. But one time, not that long ago, 6 months ago or something, I was really upset about something. I was kind of hyperventilating, and I felt like, you don't understand at all, you know, and right when I need you, you totally have checked out on me. And these are normal couple dynamics sometimes. They certainly are for us sometimes. And he Normally he would feel kind of like overwhelmed by me getting intense like that. And he would be like, we're going to talk in 10 minutes. And we have a rule. You get to do that. You get to have a break if you need one. Yeah. But he turned around and he like put his hands on my shoulders nicely. And he said, I'm right here. Mm. I see you. I see what's going on and I'm not going anywhere.
Wow.
And I was like, oh. It was the only time in my life I ever had that feeling.
Wow.
Of just like just total safety.
Deep in your soul. Yeah.
Total safety. And so for somebody like me who was always like getting all my fuel from the chase, there's nothing to chase anymore. Yeah. And I'm getting to experience what love really is.
Mm.
And it's the most healing thing in the world. It's lovely.
That's incredible. Yeah. So useful to hear. Examples like this, thank you so much for sharing. I think for other people who aren't maybe, you know, initially attracted to more stable, safe partners, but just to know like long term, the benefits, the love, the safety you feel from these relationships, it's like you can't even compare it to the fuel you get from chasing someone unavailable like that.
All right, beloveds, we will resume our lessons tomorrow and let that marinate. From me, the matriarch, I bid you farewell.